And not only welcome to all of you here, but welcome to all those around the world listening in on ACB Radio. I don't know how all of you are feeling, but it's only Friday morning and I'm pretty tired. But what a fun start to convention. Kevin Daniel is quite a bartender, so I've heard. And anyway, thank you to the South King Council of the Blind for sponsoring hospitality last night, and to all of you who came to the board meeting, pre-convention board meeting last night. And wasn't the breakfast delicious this morning? And I don't know if any of you have run into James, who is the head chef. Lots of people have. He is everywhere, and he's overseeing all of the preparation of our meals, as well as he oversees the restaurant. He's amazing, so be sure to thank him when he helps you out, because he's just everywhere. So, yeah. Okay. So we're going to get started. We have some ceremonial things we do at the beginning of a convention. So presentation of the colors. I invite Scout Troop 361 from Federal Way. Please stand.
Color guard, attention. Color guard, forward march. Audience, salute. Color guard, halt. Color guard, prepare to post the colors. Please join with me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Color guard, post the colors. Color guard, salute. Two. Color guard, fall back. Color guard, halt. Audience may be seated.
Thank you so much. Well done. That was very nice and very verbal. Appreciated that very much, so we knew what was going on. Nice job, gentlemen. I now invite Tim Claire Coper, police and fire chaplain for South King County, for our invocation.
I think this is the first time I've ever heard a dog applaud. My wife grew up with a dear friend who has gradually lost her sight over the last few years. She moved here from Illinois, and when there wasn't a council chapter, she responded by helping start one. And I was not at all surprised when I arrived here this morning finding her leading a tour of the hotel for some people who wanted it. Watching Galen transition has made my wife and I aware of so many things that we had never really noticed before. Watching her accomplish great things, not despite, but I think in many ways because of her loss of sight, has been a tremendous inspiration to my wife and I, and I was very honored to be asked to give the invocation. Let's pray. We pause this morning, our God, to ask you for your blessing on this convention and on the many people who have traveled here to attend it. We pray that this time together will stimulate and enhance the desire to learn and grow and encourage a sense of fellowship with those around them that share both diverse and similar challenges and opportunities. May this experience together remind them of the need to treasure both independence as well as true camaraderie. We're grateful for the example they all set to us of courage and perseverance, resilience, unity of mind, and strength of purpose. May they go from this place and this convention challenged, reinforced, encouraged, and uplifted. We pray this in your great name, invoking your presence among us. Amen.
Amen. Very nice. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That was great. Now I would like to invite, Pam Fernald, SeaTac City Council member, to provide us a welcome to SeaTac.
Good morning, Washington Council of the Blind.
Good welcome.
Welcome to the city of SeaTac, a city where everywhere is possible. We're happy to have you and thank you for bringing your great conference to our city. The city of SeaTac was incorporated in February 1990 and is located approximately midway between the cities of Seattle and Tacoma. The city is approximately 10.5 square miles and has a population of 25,100. The Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, owned and operated by the Port of Seattle, is located within the city of SeaTac boundaries and is actually right across the street from where we are now to the west. With the exception of downtown Seattle, the city of SeaTac has the Puget Sound region's largest concentration of hotels and motels, and you're in one of the nicest ones, with over 5,000 guest rooms and thousands of visitors every year. I'm going to give a plug to one of my favorite places here. It's about a mile away, and if you guys get a chance, you might go up there. It's a real nugget in a city where a big airport is, but it's called the Cedarbrook Lodge, and it's very Northwest inspired, and they have a nice warming fireplace and all kinds of neat, you know, food for the Northwest. So if you can get down there, you will enjoy it if you can get down there. So with our light rail and international airport, the city of SeaTac is proud to be the portal to the Puget Sound region and beyond. We currently have one light rail station, actually just down at the bottom of this hill, which has enhanced our connection to the greater Puget Sound area. And we have a second light rail station that will be opening next year. So if you just go a block or two down the hill, and there's the light rail, and it will take you down into the city of Seattle if anybody cares to venture down there. So during your stay, we hope you'll have an opportunity to experience our many fine restaurants and visit the scenic Angle Lake Park, Valley Ridge Park, North SeaTac Park, and our community center, where at North SeaTac Park, we have a sensory garden, which you might find very enjoyable, and also a botanical garden and a tranquil Japanese garden. So we have lots of gardens. They smell good. There's lots of things to touch and feel and find your way, listen to the water and everything. Or you might like to take a leisurely walk along the Des Moines Creek Trail. So here in SeaTac, we strive to make our city a premier global community, offering a solid, sustainable economy and a healthy, inclusive, and vibrant quality of life. We're confident you'll enjoy your time in SeaTac, and we'll find the people that live and work here to be friendly and helpful. And I've certainly seen that just the little while I've been in this hotel. These guys seem to be great here. So have a great convention, and again, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Pam. Thank you so much, Pam. Well, I've lived in the Puget Sound area for 35 plus years, and I learned something new. So there you go. Thank you. That was great. Now I would love to invite Galen Floy, president of the South King Council of the Blind, to give the host chapter welcome.
Thank you, Cindy.
In Espanol, bienvenidos. In Vietnamese, honen. In Arabic, alam wasalam. In Laotian, nien di. In Texan, welcome, y'all. It's good to see everybody here. And my challenge to you, every one of you today, even those OTC students, people who are brand new to an experience like this, get to know someone you've never met before. During the day, shake hands, introduce yourself, ask them where they came from, ask them their most embarrassing moment as a blind person. And that's how we get to become family. So we're here to support, and if there's anything you need during the day, please feel free to let anybody from my chapter let us know what's going on, and we're here to serve. So thank you so much, and have a great day.
Okay. Steve, could you give me the time, please?
It is 8:58.
Okay. Well, we're a couple minutes early. So two things. I think we will do a one-door prize.
We're not ready yet.
Because we weren't going to do them until later. But
we're not ready yet.
Oh, you're not ready? Get ready. Get ready. I'll talk a little bit, but you get ready.
Yes, ma'am.
So, okay. My goodness. And okay. So one of the things that I want to piggyback on what Galen just spoke about is that, And I think we can easily do this. Somewhere sitting near you is someone you don't know. If you're sitting next to somebody you do know, then I don't want you talking to that person. I want you to turn around, talk to the person next to you or in front of you right now, and introduce yourself and meet somebody new. So do that right now. And there's lots of chatter, so people are doing what I ask. That's great. All right, hon. Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay. Now, you don't have to tell your whole life story. Just introduce yourself. You guys are doing a great job. Three, two... One. Hello, WCB.
Hello.
So, did you get to meet someone new?
Yes.
Isn't that nice? I really want to challenge you all to do this each time you sit down in our general sessions. Not necessarily to have that jolly of a conversation when somebody's up here talking, of course. But I'm talking about during the breaks, or if you sit next to someone, you could whisper over to them and say, "Hi, who's that next to me?" It's a great way for us to get to know one another. We want everybody to feel welcome, and we can't see each other, and so it would be very easy for someone to get lost in the mix and to feel unwanted. And that is certainly not WCB style, to make people feel unwelcome or unwanted, right? So we all need to work together to reach out to one another and make sure people feel connected, okay? So I'm putting it all on you. I also want to mention that John DiMicio is our official photographer for our event. He volunteers his services and does a great job. And he's from the Capital City Council of the Blind. So as I mentioned several things last night and thanked people, things get crazy throughout the weekend. And in case I forget to mention John, if you're in the room, we appreciate you. So, yeah. All right, and he is in the room. Oh, good. Woo. Okay. Because we, you know, might have had to clap louder or something if you weren't in the room. Door prize people, are you ready yet?
I need the names. So that's
Tim?
What I'm missing. Your sister went to go get them.
Oh, Tim was supposed to get them. Okay, that's what we're waiting on.
I have the prizes. I just need the...
Okay, well, that's Sometimes, you know, jobs don't always get done as quick as you think. Okay. All right. Well, then I guess you'll have to wait until after my president's report, okay? All right. So stay put. Who? Yes. That's at the business meeting. So if you are president who sent me in memoriam information on people who passed away in the last year from your chapter, I have that list written down. If you did not let me know, then probably at lunch might be a good time to come and see me or sometime throughout today or tomorrow morning. Okay? All right. You bet. Okay. President's report. In March 3rd, 1990, two organizations with probably several diverse views at times, people with lots of differences, possibly organizations that never dreamt they'd combine, join hands, merged in Issaquah. It was about 100 people present at that event. And it was decided then that the name would remain Washington Council of the Blind. There was a previous organization of the Washington Council of the Blind and the United Blind of Washington State, which has a several organization history changing names throughout its years. We can link the blindness organizations back to 1935. Organized blind in the state of Washington. But for today, not to minimize the importance of anything any of those organizations pre-1990 did, I want to speak just from 1990 to today. In 1990, the first president of the Washington Council of the Blind was Sue Amateur. Sue served two terms, and then we had our next president was Sharon Kiran. She is deceased, but many of you will remember Sharon, and she served for one term. And then Sue didn't have enough, so she came back and served two more terms again. So there was a lot of growing in the 1990s. Maybe not in size as far as numbers goes, but in learning, in changing. I did an exercise in our president's breakfast this morning and asked everybody to share what they were doing in 1990. It was pretty fun, actually, to listen to different people's perspectives on where they were 25 years ago. So you could think on your own about what you were doing in 1990. I'm going to tell you what I was doing. I was in my 20s. I had a four-year-old daughter. I gave birth to my youngest daughter in December of that year. So both of my girls in the last 25 years have grown up. They're grown women now. My oldest daughter lives in New York with her husband who serves in the Navy, and they have three beautiful children who are my grandchildren, and I love them dearly. And my parents who are here in the room, they were much younger then. In fact, my parents, so this is kind of interesting how this could happen, so the mathematicians among you, 25 years ago, my parents were younger than I am today. Yikes. So, in fact, if you guys would all help me, my parents have been married 55 years as of September. Um, My dad turned 75 in August. Mom turns 75 this month. They have always been my greatest supporters, encouraged me, always let me know that I could. I don't remember them telling me I can't do something. And sometimes we had to fake it so that I could do things, you know? I can remember going horseback riding. I know I'm digressing, but I remember going horseback riding when we'd go camping, and my mom would just say, just get on the horse and don't say anything. And because they didn't want a blind kid, they saw me as a liability, you know? And it was long before the ADA, there wasn't a lot for us to stand on. And I remember one time I got on that horse, and normally the reins would be, you know, sitting on top on the horse. Yes. Well, that particular time it wasn't, and the handler came over and was handing me the reins, and I couldn't see the handler handing me the reins. And my mom had to say, Cindy, reach out, and I grabbed the reins, and then of course they went over and talked to my mom and said, can she see? Is she blind? Is it safe for her to ride, you know? And they rode with us out to the gate and saw I was fine and let us go. But so my mom absolutely was my biggest, mom was my biggest cheerleader. I think mom protected me from the naysayers that said I couldn't and made sure that I didn't have to listen to that and knew that. So I always grew up knowing that whatever it was, I could. Now, I bring back us to, but help me thank my parents, because they are here and I love them dearly, so. But that brings me back to 1990. And I think about 1990 when I had my little family. And I can honestly say to you, I never dreamt of becoming president of Washington Council of the Blind, the finest blindness organization in the country. Never, yes. never imagined it then. And I think about all the changing that's taken place in my life, all the growing that's happened in me, all the experiences that I've encountered that have charted my course, you know, created my path, the ups, the downs, losing loved ones, you know, divorce, any of the bad and the good. And I think about the strength that the last 25 years has brought me really comes from all of those experiences and most importantly, the people. People are the most important piece of all of it. But there's definitely been change. I know I'm changed. I know you're changed. And if you're a young adult in your early 20s or somewhere in your 20s, in 25 years, you'll be in the 50-ish range. And you'll go, where did it all go? Because it goes by really fast. In some ways, I feel like I'm not a lot different, you know, because so much of me is still the same. But I know I'm better. I'm better than I was 25 years ago. And I know how to love. I know how to love deeper. I know how to care more. I know how to be patient more. I even know how to be more forgiving. And so hopefully, you know, somewhere you can say that in your life. And even in 25 years, I hope I can do all of those things more in 25 years from now. But WCB has undergone lots of changes. We had all these differences, different people come together in 1990. And so we did go through some growing pains. There's no doubt about it. But we also had some really wonderful ways that we worked together to make things happen. And I might ask for some help from the audience as I think about some of the key changes. So if you are especially in leadership of WCB, and you remember something really key that we worked on. I might ask you to shout it out, but I'm going to say that in the 90s, we helped pass the Braille Bill, which was huge for the education of blind children in our state. And in the last 20 years, I've had the privilege of working with blind students teaching Braille. And what a highlight for me. And it's extra special. You know how things, what goes around comes around and all of that stuff. Some of my students are active members in this organization and are in this room now. If you were one of my students, clap your hands. I know I have a few of them. Well, I have two. But I know there's a few. So anyway, Michelle's here. So, I continue to work with kids, and I'm now working with a little second grader. And she said to me the other day, I'd been working with her 6 days. She learned the Braille alphabet, 6 days. And I had her on the Braille writer, and I said, now you know your whole alphabet. I want you to write some words. You can write anything you want. So she wrote, and I went to read it, and it said, I space L-I-K-E space Y-U. And it just warmed my heart, and I said, well, I like you too. And she goes, and I like Braille. I really like Braille. So when we hear about whether Braille is still alive and whether or not it's still something that people need, and, you know, it is something we need. It is still something we need to teach children, need to learn it, become solid, fluid readers of Braille. That's right. And it's never too late to learn Braille. I'm going to just tell you. And that you'll be hearing from Hadley School later this morning. They have some great Braille programs that they teach, and correspondence-wise, and great programs that you could learn Braille if you so chose to do. Challenge yourself. Take a course. Over the past 15 years, more than once, we've had to fight for some of those services that we have from our state agencies. Some of you will remember us standing on Capitol Hill fighting for our library services. We have fought to keep, that's right, we have fought to keep our Washington Talking Book and Braille Library stationed in its current location in Seattle, and we won. Not that long ago, we fought to keep our state agency of Department of Services for the Blind a separate state agency. They wanted, that's right, they wanted to move it into a Department of, I think, Social and Health Services. I remember going to speak to the representative for the governor at the time. There was a few of us from WCB and NFBW that went. And the lady at that table, she said, change is going to happen, whether you like it or not. And so, and she was talking about us being swept into DSHS. And we were adamant that we didn't want that to happen. And she said, it's going to happen, so you need to tell us, you know, what, how you think it should look when it does happen, not that it's not going to happen. She was pretty adamant about it. And we fought, and we won. And for those of you who wonder why you should join an organization of the blind, I'm telling you, those are some examples of why. Because it is one person speaking up sometimes isn't enough. And when you come as an organized body, you can create change. And WCB continues to fight not only for change, sometimes it's also fighting for what we have so it doesn't change into something we don't want to have, right? Okay, so together we can do so much. Now, I know there's a few other key things that we've done. Sue, can you think of anything out there? Right. We did. We fought. That's how the Environmental Access Committee really got started, was fighting for accessible kiosks back in the 90s. And we still have some work to do there, but...
ADA.
And certainly the ADA, yes. We had key people from WCB involved in the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990. So those are just some highlights. But most importantly, it is a reminder of what we can do as an organization. And we've certainly supported many things through our grant program. We've supported things at the School for the Blind and at Department of Services for the Blind, the library, the Louis Braille Center, and then the Louis Braille School, National Braille Press, Washington Access Fund, the Audiobooks Ministries, and so many more deserving organizations we have supported through our grant program. And if this organization sees it fit, we haven't had any money in our grant program for the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years. We hope to bring back funding for that again if you approve it tomorrow. So some of the changes in the last 4 years that I want to highlight are forum calls. If you know of our forum calls or have taken part in them, clap your hands. Okay. And if you do not know what I'm talking about, clap your hands. Okay, it's almost even. So about 4 years ago, we started our forum calls. And they are a way to get together across the state. And you don't have to get dressed even. I don't care if you're in your jammies or not. But you can join these calls. And each week, we have a different theme. So on the first Tuesday of the month, we hold our employment forum, and it was one of the first ones that got started, and currently it is facilitated by Julie Brannon, and that is on the first Tuesday of the month, and it is at, is it at 8 o'clock? 8 o'clock p.m. On the second Tuesday of the month is our technology forum, and it is currently facilitated by Deb Lewis, and it takes place at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, the second Tuesday of the month. All these calls last 1 hour. And on the third Tuesday, we have the book forum. It's a book club, and our current facilitator is Casey Dutmer. And then on the fourth Tuesday of the month, we have a special events forum. So we've held different ones, and this month, it will be on holidays, on the holidays. How do you handle the holidays, traditions in your family? And so you can call and share, and that's being sponsored by the Membership and Aging and Blindness Committee. So we hope you'll join. And those are all at 7, except for the first one. And then on the fourth Monday of the month, we have our Diabetics Forum, which... has been going on for a long time. It's a support group for those who are blind and are dealing with diabetes. And it's at 7. And then we just started our newest forum, is our parenting. Oh, and the Diabetics Forum is facilitated by Sharon Schauer. And then our parenting forum is on the second Sunday of each month. And that is now facilitated by Haley Eggers. And we have been getting some positive feedback from that, and welcome any blind parent, mom or dad, who has children still living at home. We really hope you'll consider joining the call. And if you aren't yourself a parent with children at home, but you know of someone, let them know about the calls. I know Haley would love to see that group grow. Right now it's of a lot of parents to be, but we know that they could certainly learn a lot from parents who have been, you know? So, because that's how we learn from one another. And the other thing that's really happened in the last 4 years, and I feel like it almost happened seamlessly, and that is our transition from cassettes to the digital formats for our news line. Yes. And we contract with Audiobooks Ministries. They do a great job, and they actually record the audio version, and then they send them out for us on the Library of Congress type cartridges. And then when you're done with them, you send them back. And then it's also available on for download on our website, as well as the text version. We have the email version that goes out for the newsline, and then the large print. So there's a variety of ways that you can read Newsline. And but that digital version, it was kind of scary. If we talked about it too much, it was very scary. So we kind of didn't talk about it a lot. We just did it. We put a plan in place that would allow us to keep kind of two things going at once. We got the digital version going while the cassettes were still going. And then we were able to transition to the digital. And I want to thank all of those who have been involved over the years with the producing of the cassettes. We did that for many years. The recording of them, the duplicating of them, mailing them out. It was a big job. And it's so nice that, you know, we don't have to call on you now. I hope you're putting your efforts now in other places in your chapter, because we know you have so much to give. So the other thing I want to talk about is your chapters. If you're a member at large, nothing replaces a chapter. The camaraderie that can be established in a chapter is really irreplaceable. But sometimes when you get groups of people together, you have personality differences. Some people call them personality clashes. When we call them clashes, that sounds a little bit negative, doesn't it? But we do have personality differences, because guess what? We are all different, right? All right. So we need to embrace those differences. We need to learn how to work with one another. And I was reminding the presidents today, because I am a lurker on many of the chapter email lists, so I know a lot of activity that goes on in chapters. And I know sometimes, and also on our own email list, and I know sometimes emotions get ahead of really what we really think and feel. And so I want us to remember a couple of things about working with one another in this organization, WCB, and in your local chapter. And the first thing and the most important thing is I want us to remember to be kind to one another. Kindness is not a huge word. It's not difficult. Sometimes it's difficult to act upon. Sometimes it's tough to be kind to people that aren't kind to us. But you've ever heard the word, you know, you can, to kill it with kindness, right? Sometimes you could stop the negative encounters with that kindness, that one act. So I want to remind you to be kind, to not react, to not be reactive, especially in a day when social media, Facebook is a way for, an email is a way for us to just respond. We quickly write, or dictate something that maybe isn't so nice, and we send. And then we wish we didn't send, because we know, oops, and you can't take it back. So I know I had to learn it early on in the days of when email was first new, But I want to caution you or to remind you to step back from those emails that get your heart pounding, your heart racing, that get you stressed. You know whatever your stresses are. Get you shaking, get you crying, whatever they are. And think, really, did that person intend to hurt my feelings? Because sometimes we respond to things and it was about a topic, not about us personally, but we take it that way. And I know I'm spending some time on something that maybe you guys don't think is important, but I think it's really important because how we treat one another really says a lot about who we are as an organization. And in every chapter, it might take a little work to be kind to some. Believe me, I know. I don't think anybody in this room could say that I'm not kind to them. And sometimes it takes a little more work to be kind. I pray it never shows because my heart wants to be kind. But sometimes it's a little harder. I'll admit that. Sometimes my feelings are hurt, and I have to work past my feelings. But when I do, I feel better. And I want everybody to feel welcome and cared about. And I don't want us to care just about somebody when they have cancer or when they've passed away. I want each of you to feel cared about now, in the now, and every tomorrow. Yes. So if there's any kind of legacy that I leave as president, this is my last time talking to you from the podium as president. If there's anything that I could leave with you, it's to put action behind the caring of one another and to be kind. My daughter, when she was about 8 or so, Amanda, she said that, maybe she was 10, she said that she heard a toast, and it was, "Here's to the differences that make us the same." And it stuck with me. You know, we are all different, but in so many ways, we are the same. And if we can just embrace each other's differences, we not only are better individually, but we become a stronger organization collectively. One of my favorite quotes, and I think it stands true to the motto of WCB, which is opportunity, equality, and independence, is from, it's ability is little account without opportunity. And that's from Napoleon Bonaparte. And ability is little account without opportunity. How do we know what you can do if we never give you a chance? So I want you all to leave with a resolve that you will not only embrace change as WCB did in that merger March 3rd, 1990, that has helped us grow into the 450 plus members we are today, with over 200 people registered for this convention. I want you to not only embrace that change as an organization, but for you personally to stretch yourself and to allow yourself to be challenged to new experience, to be exposed to new experience and new opportunities so you can gain new abilities. Thank you so much for electing me as your president. It has been an honor to serve, and I can genuinely say that I care about and love each and every one of you. And to ACB Radio, too bad you don't live in Washington. We wish you were here. Thank you. Do we have the door prize people now?
Yes, you do have me.
Okay, and if we have Mika, if Lene Noggle is in the room, if she could find the door prize table, because she was supposed to help with that. And Lori, if you could make your way to the podium, we'll have one door prize, please.
Okay, so I have a package of Tim Hortons coffee, a coffee mug that looks like it's a travel mug, and $25 from the United Blind of Whatcom County.
Ooh, a good one.
Right here, Lori.
That goes to Wilson Charles.
Wilson, are you in the room? Just a minute. Wilson, are you in the room? He's not here. He had to go to school. Sorry, okay. Wilson. Draw another name.
I got you.
You can put him back in, though, after this, you know, drawing.
Yeah. Okay. It was upside down. All right. Do we have Mike McGuire's?
Majors.
Sorry. I can't spell.
Mike, can't talk. Mike, are you in the room? Is he in the room? He is. Mike is here from my chapter. Yay.
Steve, can you help put the mic over here to Lori? I'm right here.
Are you able to stand up here? Okay. All right. Now we're going to have the report of the nominating committee. Very important that members listen up. And those of you who are not members, you can watch our process. I am going to have Lori give the report, the slate of the nominating committee, and then afterwards, I will ask for anybody, I will go through the different offices and ask if anybody else, this is not nominations, but if anybody else is interested in running for a position. So for right now, it'll be just Lori giving the nominating committee report.
Hello, everybody. I hope everybody's having a great time. I'll tell you, registration is hopping. Okay, the 2015 nominating committee, and I have to thank them graciously, is Julie Brannon and Jolene Ferguson. And for our slate of nominees this year, for president, we are putting the name forward of Steve Fixtel.
No clapping, guys.
For first vice president, Mika White. Please, can you hold your clapping until we're done? Okay. For treasurer, we are putting forward the name Debbie. Oh my gosh, I just went brain dead. Lewis, I'm sorry, Debbie. For the three directors, for director position one, we are putting the name Jim Turry. For director position two, we are putting forward the name Danette Dixon. And for director position three, we are putting forward the name of Danielle Mayer. Mar. Sorry, Danielle. For alternate delegates, we're putting forward the name of Cindy Van Winkle. That is the slate for this year's nominations.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Lori. And I just want to mention that Steve Vandekar was originally on the nominating committee, and he passed away suddenly in early October. And Jolene then was added to the nominating committee. So for those of you who were at the board meeting and or looked in your, I guess it wasn't in the bulletin, but at the board meeting, the names are different today than they were then, so I just wanted to make mention of that. Now, I'm going to go through each office, and you don't need the microphone if you just shout out your name when I say, and this is if you are planning to put your name forward. Now, tomorrow during the business meetings, you will need to have somebody nominate you from the floor to officially get your name in to be considered, okay? But this is your opportunity to let everybody else know that you're interested in running for a position. So is there anyone interested in putting their name for president? Okay, is there anyone interested in putting their name for first vice president? Is there anyone interested in putting their name in for treasurer? Is there anyone, I suspect I'm going to hear some names here. So is there anyone interested in putting their name in for director? No one? John McConnell from Pierce County Association of the Blind. Is there anyone else planning to put their name in for a director position? Is there anyone, and you can, of course, change your mind. This is not nominations.
Holly is, but she may not be in the room.
Okay. So Frank said that Holly Kaczmarski is planning to. Okay. And is there anyone planning to put their name in for alternate delegate? Okay. That is the nominating committee report and what we have going on. Now, if you are planning to run, you will be given 3 minutes for a for a speech. It can be broken into two different speakers for you. So you want to have those prepared. You don't want to come to the meeting and ask somebody to speak for you from the microphone that does not know they're doing that. That's not a good way of doing things. And you want to make sure you have somebody prepared to nominate you. The people on the slate of the nominating committee do not need to be nominated from the floor, just those that are running that are not coming from the slate, okay? All right. I now invite to the podium the chair of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee, Frank Cuda.
Oh, sorry, Frank.
Sorry about that. Oh, good morning now. It gets exciting. So, Rhonda, are you going to read from up here, or you can have someone hold the wireless mic for you? Rhonda's going to do our first reading of our proposed amendments. We have five of them. Rhonda? Rhonda? Are you going to come up here? Okay, good.
Yeah, it's probably easier.
There's a great mic there on the table.
I didn't know I wasn't supposed to. Yeah, there's a mic on the table, too.
Yeah.
Is this okay?
Yeah, just at the table there.
Yeah, that table mic is really good. Use this that, one. Rhonda.
All right.
It's a condenser. It's really nice.
I thought you were going to do some explaining.
Oh, no, we don't normally do a lot of explaining. Okay. Just read. We're going to do our first reading.
Thank you.
And there are five of them. I'm just going to help with it.
I do.
There's no question. Well, there's no discussion.
Yeah,
we could answer a question or two.
Do you want the summaries? I think we do want the summaries.
Okay. We hope to just get by with a reading, the first reading, and we have these in large print and in Braille. And, of course, we'll be actually voting on them on Saturday afternoon. So you ready, Rhonda?
I am.
Let's go.
Amendment 2015-1. This changes the eligibility for crisis assistance from once in a lifetime to once every 5 years. So our existing language is Bylaw 10, WCB Crisis Aid Program. C, eligibility. All legally blind persons in the state of Washington qualify for crisis aid, including those who are not members of WCB. Applicants may be required to provide documentation of legal blindness. This is a one-time only award. Persons who are not legally blind or who have received crisis aid in the past are not eligible to apply. Our proposed language is Bylaw 10, WCB Crisis Aid Program, C, eligibility. All legally blind persons in the state of Washington qualify for crisis aid, including those who are not members of WCB. Applicants may be required to provide documentation of legal blindness. Persons who are not legally blind or who have received crisis aid in the previous 5 years are not eligible to apply. Okay, Amendment 2015-2, and this is a clarification of who qualifies for first-timer awards to the state convention. And what we're trying to do is prevent former exhibitors and scholarship winners from being disqualified. We don't want those people disqualified for that reason. So our existing language is Bylaw 8, First-Timers and Their Sponsorship to the WCB State Convention, Section A, Sentence 4. First-timers must not have previously attended a WCB state convention. Our proposed language is Bylaw 8, First-Timers and Their Sponsorship to the WCB State Convention, Section A, Sentence 4. First-timers must not have previously attended a WCB state convention as a registered voting member. Okay, Amendment 2015-3, whoa. And this has to do with filling vacancies on the board. And it kind of, it's a correction that clarifies a statement that was ambiguous in Article 6 that currently stipulates that an appointed replacement will serve until the next business meeting. And actually what happened is they not only serve until the replacement is elected, but until that person formally takes office on January 1. So it's just a clarification of to make the bylaws kind of in concurrence with what we actually are doing. So, existing language. Article 6, officers and their duties. Section 5, vacancies. Should a vacancy occur in the office of president, the first vice president shall function as president until the next business meeting of the organization, at which time the membership shall hold an election to fill the office of president for the remainder of the term. Should a vacancy occur in any office other than president, the board of directors shall appoint a replacement slash replacements to serve until the next business meeting of the organization. So our proposed language is Article 6, Officers and Their Duties, Section 5, Vacancies. Should a vacancy occur in the office of president, the first vice president shall function as president. At the next business meeting of this organization, a new president shall be elected. Should a vacancy occur in any office other than president, the board of directors shall appoint a temporary replacement. At the next business meeting of this organization, this position will be filled using the normal election process. Amendment 2015-4. Reducing the advance notification requirement placed on the nominating committee from 20 days to 10 days. Our existing language is Bylaw 1, Section R, Sentence 3. The nominating committee shall report the proposed list of candidates on the WCB email list and notify the chair of the telephone committee so that the telephone service can be updated no less than 20 days prior to the opening session of the fall convention. And the proposed language is Bylaw 1, Section R, Sentence 3. The nominating committee shall report the proposed list of candidates on the WCB email list and notify the chair of the telephone committee so that the telephone service can be updated no less than 10 days prior to the opening session of the fall convention. Amendment 2015-5, and you'll be happy to know this is our last one, updates the purpose of the Environmental Access Committee. The existing language is Bylaw 1, Section G, Environmental Access. This committee addresses environmental access issues specific to blindness. It tracks and reports such concerns to the board and members of WCB. Okay, the proposed language, and we made a couple little changes last night, so Frank, help me if I messed this up. Bylaw 1, Section G, Environmental Access. The Environmental Access Committee addresses environmental access issues specific to blindness and vision loss in the built environment. The committee also makes recommendations when WCB finds common cause with other communities affected by a specific issue. The committee concentrates on issues related to transportation, including public transit funding, street design, walkability, and accessible pedestrian signals. It promotes the implementation of universal design methodology. The committee provides information to individual members and chapters, promoting efforts to resolve issues in local jurisdictions. That's it.
Okay, if you've been sitting on the edge of your seats, you can now relax. Madam Chairman, that completes the report of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee.
That's very good. Thank you. Can we do one door prize?
Okay. All right. We have a, it is a knitted, it's a, or rather a crocheted beanie with $25. That was donated by Carl Gibson. And go ahead and give me. Oh, Carl, what is it?
Carl Gibson Senior Center.
Oh, Carl Gibson Senior Center. All right, Heidi Campbell. Yay!
Heidi, are you here? Fabulous.
All right.
That's good. All right. Oh, there it is.
And we might need more door prizes down here.
Okay. Rhonda's reading of the Constitution and Bylaws reminded me, though, of, it showed how important Braille is, because for those of you who couldn't see her, she was reading that all from Braille. Absolutely. Okay. Now, our keynote address, Accomplishments and Challenges Under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I ask you to help me welcome Toby Olson, Executive Director, Governor's Committee on Disability Issues and Employment.
Thank you.
Good morning. Yeah. So, 25 years ago, through the enactment of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the United States took a great step forward toward fulfilling its promise as a nation that recognizes, respects, and defends inherent, universal human equality. I can't think of anything that's more fundamentally American than that. Universal equality was the first principle, the first truth that we claimed for ourselves in the Declaration of Independence. It was the justification that we offered to the rest of the world for our right to form our own nation. And our struggles, failures, and successes at living up to that promise have been the central story of that nation ever since. Now, the fact that we're still struggling so hard and so haltingly to accomplish something that we declared to be a self-evident truth 239 years ago could make us cynical, I suppose. Or the fact that that struggle, in all of its myriad forms, has never been abandoned. The fact that there has always been a core of individuals working to draw the nation's attention to injustice and engage the nation's conscience in ending injustice. And the fact that there have been so many victories helping us to move toward becoming more just and inclusive, as incomplete and imperfect as those victories have been, all of that, I think, should make us proud and hopeful and committed to adding our own small contributions to the continuing process of forming a more perfect union. When Dr. Martin Luther King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, he was recognizing that there are many pushes and tugs that shape the course of that arc. He was recognizing that his work and the work of others during his lifetime made up only one section of that arc. When he said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, he was paraphrasing the words of an abolitionist, Theodore Parker, who said that more than a century earlier. And by paraphrasing those words from a previous century, he was drawing attention to the multi-generational nature of the movement toward justice. For the last 25 years, the Americans with Disabilities Act has been part of the arc of the moral universe, making its own contribution to the bend toward justice. The ADA was the first national law of any country with the purpose of providing a clear and comprehensive national mandate to end discrimination against individuals with disabilities and to bring those individuals into the economic and social mainstream. In the 25 years since its enactment, the ADA, along with the disability amendments to the Fair Housing Act, the Telecommunications Act, and the Air Carrier Access Act, have dramatically changed every aspect of life for people with disabilities in this country and have served as models for disability rights laws in other countries around the world. The ADA also served as an inspiration and model for the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which, sadly, the United States so far has declined to ratify. Some other interesting things have happened over those 25 years, including the rise of a whole generation of people with disabilities who have never experienced living with a disability without the ADA. Now, a lot of the people that I would put in that post-ADA generation are older than I am. And for those of you who don't know, that's really old. Because I would argue that if a generation means a cohort of people with a shared history and shared experiences, then generations of people with disabilities has more to do with when a person becomes a person with a disability than it does with when they were born. And most people who have disabilities acquire those disabilities as adults. So regardless of the age of our post-ADA generation, that generation can miss the evidence all around them of how transformative the ADA has been because they've never experienced anything else. They never experienced a world without paratransit or one in which the bus driver might call your stop if you asked nicely, or they might not. Under the ADA, we keep getting better and better at stop calling. I think so anyway. So now the requirement is not just your requested stop and the connection stops and the major intersections. It's also required that if the route goes for a while without a stop, that they call out information about where the bus is in its route so riders can stay oriented. Now, are bus drivers doing that yet? No? Well, we need to keep working on that. But that's the direction now from the feds. So soon after the ADA was signed, the Easter Seals took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, and I think some other publications too. So the ad showed a bound printed copy of the ADA, full-page ad, this thick bound copy of the ADA, with the caption underneath that said, "For millions of Americans, this is their first bus pass." And it isn't just buses. It's all public transportation, from cruise ships to Uber and Lyft, whether they know it yet or not. The post-ADA generation never experienced a world in which people with speech and hearing disabilities couldn't make all of the same kinds of telephone calls as everybody else, to the same places, the same people. But until the ADA created universal telephone relay service, most people who were deaf could only make phone calls to somebody who had a TTY, usually another deaf person. Only a few larger communities had any kind of relay service at all. I directed a program that operated one of those relay services, and it was staffed by volunteers, it had limited hours, it could only relay calls from local numbers to local numbers. It couldn't handle more than one call at a time. So pre-ADA telecommunications for the deaf was like trying to peek through a keyhole while the whole rest of the world was looking at the world from orbiting satellites. The post-ADA generation never experienced a world in which students with disabilities who met all the requirements for admission were routinely turned away from colleges and universities or told, you need to go to that one school because that's the school that takes people like you. The post-ADA generation is one in which every Volk school, every community college, every university has an office to coordinate accommodations for students with all kinds of disabilities, and students with disabilities pick the schools that offer the programs they want. Or they pick the school that their boyfriend or girlfriend went to, or they might pick the best party school. The ADA does not guarantee that freshmen with disabilities will make good choices. It guarantees that they will have the right to make their own choices. And because of that guarantee, there are hundreds of thousands of students with disabilities all across the country who are getting reasonable accommodations to help them succeed in the post-secondary education program of their choice. And the ADA continues to guarantee that freedom of choice even as the nature of college education keeps changing. When many schools, including the University of Washington, set up programs in partnership with Amazon for students to get course material and schedules through inaccessible Kindle devices, the Department of Justice moved quickly to make sure that they all went back to the drawing board to make sure that students who were blind or who had other print disabilities would have equal access. Much more recently, the Department of Justice announced a huge settlement against MIT and Harvard over its edX program. That's a joint MOOC. Do folks know what a MOOC is? A MOOC is, I'll probably get this wrong, massive online open content education platform. It's a platform for doing distance learning. And this MOOC, edX, that was put together by Harvard and MIT together is huge. Hundreds of universities are using it. Last year, more than 3 million people took courses through edX. And the settlement with the Department of Justice on access in edX is wonderful. It's very strong. Access standards requires continuing monitoring and annual reviews that it stays accessible. It requires standards and training for any party that's going to develop material that would be posted to the edX platform. The Department of Justice seems to be using settlements like this one to pre-announce what's going to be in the new ADA rules on internet access. And I think that means that we should expect those rules to be very strong and very broadly applied. The post-ADA generation has never known a world in which applicants to the bar or for medical licenses or professional licenses of all kinds were routinely asked in extensive and invasive questions about their disabilities and excluded from application to those fields based on unsupported, unexamined prejudices and assumptions. The post-ADA generation has never experienced a world in which people who are deaf or hard of hearing very rarely had any communication with their health care providers other than writing notes. Prior to the ADA, St. Paul Ramsey Hospital in Minnesota did a study in which they arranged for more than 490 deaf patients who were being treated in that hospital's outpatient clinics to be seen again in the same clinics with the addition of sign language interpreters, and they found that significantly more than half had chronic, serious, obvious, often life-threatening conditions that had not been found when they were being treated without interpreters, and that a similar proportion was being treated for conditions they didn't have. A very similar study was done recently in the United Kingdom, and it had the same results. And the authors of that study observed that the patients would have been better off being treated by veterinarians. Rather than by MDs without interpreters, because veterinarians are trained in diagnosing and treating patients they can't talk with. Without the ADA, people who were deaf were routinely provided worse than veterinary medicine. Other impacts of the ADA that are often overlooked include the ability to participate effectively in the most fundamental of the rights and responsibilities of a citizen: voting and jury duty. The transformation is still happening and still reaching into new areas of people's lives. The next generation of people with disabilities after this one might never know a world in which people with disabilities are unnecessarily segregated into institutions or sheltered workshops. The generation after this one will never know a world in which movie theaters and movie distributors fail to routinely provide descriptive audio service or closed captioning for the films they show and distribute. The next generation after this one will never know a world in which websites, web-based applications, and other types of information electronic technology are not fully accessible and usable by people who have disabilities. The transformational change caused by the ADA is a continuing evolution, and the single most important change the ADA will eventually bring about will likely take quite some time. That is the change of creating a mature public dialogue about disability that is informed by the experiences of people with disabilities instead of the inaccurate myths, stereotypes, and assumptions that continue to dominate the common, strongly held beliefs about people who have disabilities in the lives we lead. There have been dozens of studies that have all shown not just a disconnect, but an immense chasm between the popular assumptions and the actual experiences of people with disabilities. One of the earliest studies compared overall satisfaction and happiness rates for people with paraplegia and people who had won the lottery. And they found that once you get past that initial stage of disruptive change, there ends up being not much difference. The best predictor for quality of life after the change, whether the change was becoming paraplegic or winning the lottery, was not which change you had. The best predictor was what was your quality of life before the change. It turns out that no matter where you go, there you are. And that's pretty good news, I think, because we all have a much better chance of getting a spinal cord injury than we have for picking those winning numbers. And it's good to know that either way, once we've adjusted to the change, we're likely to end up being just about as happy as we are right now. Another of the studies has the title Ignorance of Hedonic Adaptation to Hemodialysis, a Study Using Ecological Momentary Assessment. Apparently in the Journal of Experimental Psychology, that's how you say that people just don't have a clue about how quickly and completely we all adjust and get on with life. The kinds of things that the popular perception of the experience of disability consistently and spectacularly underestimates include what we can do, how happy we are, our level of self-esteem, and virtually every other measure of competence, productivity, and quality of life. There isn't much evidence yet of that mature, fact-based public dialogue developing, but we will get it going. If we persist in challenging the stereotypes and examining the assumptions at every opportunity, remember, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Thank you.
Well, is this my opportunity to practice? I think Cindy stepped out of the room, but according to the agenda, it is break time. So please be back in. You think? I guess I need more practice. How about a door prize, ladies?
Well, your door prize is that you have no door prizes. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. So I have... Oh, wait. Please give me 1 second. Please hold. Mm-hmm. Oh, she can tell me. Okay. All right. Okay. I asked her if it was the right door prize and she thought it was for her. I love it. Okay. So from the King County chapter, we have $25, but I guess nobody wants that, right? And Michelle Denzer. All right. And be sure to get back from break on time.
Michelle, another what thing?
That's what I was going to do. This where I'm just like everywhere.
Oh, as far as you mean a student group? We're looking at forming a younger generation group opposed to a student organization. because what happens is by the time you get the student all excited, ready to take over, they graduate.
And it was so nice to meet you.
So we're thinking of doing an under 40.
You are at 10:30 when the break is done.
And maybe I'm thinking right now
is when
you start in tomorrow call and get some people excited about it.
Okay, fabulous.
And then see where it goes.
I'm thinking that you're good with leaving them here, right? I'm thinking that we could get them to our exhibit hall and put them on the exhibit, on the WCB exhibitors table. And then people can get them when they go to the exhibit.
Oh, you mean for North Central?
Ask somebody to run them to Carol.
You want me to run them down there myself? Or
if you don't mind, that would be great. You could
WCB and Carol's her name?
Carol is her name.
No.
She's the one in charge of the exhibits. And so just let her know that I told you, asked you to bring those down to her to put it on her table.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Okay?
Yeah. I will do that. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Your father has a note to say. He thanks you very much for coming to do this. And you didn't say anything about your sister.
I didn't say anything about my husband either.
Well, you're not supposed to say anything.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So, and I wasn't really going to even speak about what I did. I went off track, so.
And the thing with the voice is fine.
I know.
And then she said, oh, you sick.
I know. She's so funny. She's so funny.
Yes,
ma'am. I said, how come I didn't
do this? Mother's taking care. Because I kept telling her.
Well, it was mailed to me, and I got Mika's. She mailed Mika won a prize on my party. So she sent that, and she sent me a sharpener, and she sent me a catalog. So I could, and she sent me some of her postcard thingies.
Yes,
that,
I got some, too.
And I showed somebody, and they're like, that's your daughter. She's so pretty. I had somebody, Steve, listen to this one. I had a volunteer, when I left seeing you guys in the breakfast, I was walking over here, and of course I could get here, right? So I'm walking across, and he said, do you need any help? And I thought, what the heck? I said, yes, could you? So I took his arm. He goes, do you want me to help you find a seat? And I said, could you take me to the front, to the podium? And he goes, to the front? And I said, yeah, to the front. He goes, oh, what are you going to talk about? And I said, I don't know, but I'm president. And he says, I'm walking with the president. Wow, I feel really special, you know? And so and his name was Howard. So just a minute. He goes, can I tell you something? And I'm like, I don't know. And he goes, you have very pretty teeth. Seriously, isn't that hilarious?
That's
I have
great,
never
I
had
have
anybody
two.
Say that to me. And I said, I'm going to make sure I tell my dentist, Dr. Ruff, because he's so proud of my front teeth that he redid for me about 8 years ago. Every time I go in, he always says, I sure did do a good job. Isn't that funny? And that's the first time that anybody's complimented me on my teeth. And, you know, hair, your eyes, your lips. Smile.
President, I was
going
to say,
yeah,
I just wanted to
run. But you can't.
Well, I didn't say it. I wanted to.
We could poke your eyes out and then you could.
Never mind.
Oh,
no. That's right. When you gave your speech, I thought to myself, woman for president.
Oh.
Go with it.
Yeah, I could certainly get people to work across the aisles, I think. Better than some of these people. I have no idea to be a politician, though, but I'm just saying. People would just get off their high carts.
Cindy, how many do you want for luncheon?
Well, it depends on how many we have down here.
Down here, I think we have 9.
Okay, so I would say that she should hold on to 4 for the afternoon.
Okay.
And she planned on doing one right after the break and one at the end of the morning session. So that's 2, 4, and then whatever's left, 3, and for lunch.
Okay, so one when
two,
we come back.
Yeah, two one. This morning, one when we come back, one after at the end before we break for lunch, 3 during lunch. So giving people who stuck it out, right?
Yeah.
Something. 3 during the awards luncheon, and then the last 4 during the afternoon.
Okay, and what about the banquet? I mean, the luncheon itself.
I said 3 during the luncheon.
Okay, I'm so confused. Why?
2 in the later part of the morning.
When she has to do something, and then there's that gal, Lene.
Yes.
She's here.
Oh, good.
Yeah, but she's blind, and she only reads Braille, and a lot of them are print, so she needs someone to help her.
To read.
And make sure. So can you sit over there and help her? And she's never done that before, doing what she's doing. But I guess let her try to do it. Yeah, let her do it, and then just help her with, like, okay, let's use this.
Whoever wins, though, the name goes into that baggie that's there. So because we don't want to draw people's names a second time,
okay.
They'll all go back in for the banquet.
For the banquet,
So we pull them out.
Michelle won the last time.
Michelle and Mike.
Oh, Mike both won?
Yes.
Cute couple.
Yes.
He dotes on
me. I could tell.
Yes. He would not be here if it was not for Michelle. He did not want to come here. I can tell you that.
And he won 20 bucks.
They're going to go to Minnesota. And he's wanting to go just for part of the week. And Michelle is going to talk to him. I want to go for the whole week. He's like, what do you need to go for a whole week for? There's nothing there for her. He's like, oh. And she knows it's busy and it's fun.
It's fun.
So,
Minnesota, but anyway, they're
that's what I bet you this is. Oh, could be in Minneapolis.
Okay. Okay.
This is a non-Hollis meeting zone.
Well, that's what you say.
Hey, Carolyn,
huh?
Yeah. Tim. Tim.
Tim.
Hi.
He's coming over to
you. You guys don't take it personally that I didn't mention either of you.
They weren't in the room.
Okay. I was.
I did not mention either of you.
He was sitting outside.
It wasn't intended. I mean, I just...
She winged it.
I winged it.
Hey, honey, look at it.
I wasn't even necessarily...
What's your shirt?
About Mom and Dad. Right?
What's your shirt?
For a lighthouse for a blind man, a 3XLT.
Oh, good.
That's for you.
It looks like deodorizing. Are you sanitizer? And a shirt.
Good for you.
He's got to keep his pants up.
Me too. My car's
Chris Brain has a key to our room. Carolyn and you and I.
Okay.
I don't want you running up and down the stairs to get it. You know? We'll get them youngsters like Carolyn. See the ones that have all dark beans? I need to make up.
No, special ones.
Yes, special order you need to talk to.
I mean, if we did all black, if we did all chocolate, then we need to. Yeah, we should charge more.
They get that in there because she's just going into the room to do that.
Okay, I got a free shirt.
Okay, what time is it? Somebody?
No, I don't have my. Hold on. I have to call Verizon.
21. 1021.
Thank you.
1020.
Thank you. Did you get them over there?
I did.
Well, you're quick.
Yeah.
You're quick.
Yeah.
Oh, honey?
Yeah, babe.
Thank you. Reggie.
And we meet again.
Hey.
Mr. Pennsylvania.
I could be an instructor.
Do you like to be called Chuck? And I know I told you in my emails, but I really, the first course I've taken was one course, and it was the UEB transitioning to UEB.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I was one of the first.
Uh-huh.
And then
Melrose.
Sue Melrose was my instructor. Yeah. It was an excellent experience. And I ran out. And because of it, another things like presentations I've been to and stuff.
Seminars.
Not just at Howland, but from other sources like at ACB and other things. I've on ACB radio and things. I've gotten a lot of information. I'm involved in our statewide planning. For our state on transition working. So anyway, I've been doing forum calls. I did three of them. I put together a notebook of my notes, and then I took some of the BANA site and Arizona site. They have like a chart with all the with all the words and stuff and the symbols chart. There's what I'm looking for. Sorry, it's been really long. 24 hours. And I put that together, and anyway, I've got a notebook, a binder, and it's going to be auctioned off for our silent auction.
Oh, cool.
It's all my work, and it's all my work. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And I teach Braille to my children in our school district.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
Would you like some more?
Using it. Yeah, that'd be great, Arnie.
Okay, whose notebooks are these over here?
Well, this is my seat right here.
That's your...
And
There's a glass.
This is my glass.
Okay, if you can
fill it up
for
you. That'd be fun.
Thank you.
Do you have a hug for me?
You put a hug. Oh,
thank you.
Oh, okay.
You are
I got my beans already for them.
Oh, good. Oh, well, And did your other conference go well?
It went very well.
Good. Well,
State
I appreciate it.
The are over in Ohio, Seattle.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are right here after some of the people.
Uh-huh.
Sam Fry.
Yes, and Jeff Tom, I know, was there. He's coming. So, but anyway, I do appreciate you, making this part of your long trip.
We've got one of our students from China here, a former teacher.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, we have. This is one of the largest affiliate conventions. We have... over 200 registered.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And our membership's 450 something. So for us to get over 200 for a convention, it's not all members, granted, I know that, but one third of our membership is here.
Yeah. I just got an award from the Illinois Council for convention in East Peoria.
Oh, wow. So good. That was just a couple weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to give a little bit of.
don't you do whatever you want with your time. We're glad
and
for you.
I wrote this long time ago because I was a test giver by training, a work about it. Tests are not normal. I have no validity. So I wrote a tummy cheek test.
That's awesome.
For blind people to get the same thing. And this was years ago in the 90s, and Shirley Smith was the
Of course, she was past director of services for the blind here.
Yeah, she paid me to let her use it. So I gave it to her, and she used it at this convention years ago.
Oh, that's funny.
And it went over so well that they published it in the book.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I just thought I'd go back. But it's my roots. It's all come home to me when I come back here. After
that's
being
great.
Gone for 10 years. And,
yeah. That's
Paul
awesome.
Paul Jajek was the
He's actually going to be on a presentation this afternoon.
Yeah. I saw Loma
very good. Yeah, we're so fortunate in the state to have great working relationships with our agencies. You know, Danielle Miller is our manager, librarian of the library, and Dean Stangem, of course, at the school. Oh. And the past ones, of course, Furley and Bill Palmer.
It's not funny.
It's Carolyn Meyer.
Carolyn, like my name?
Yep, Meyer. M-E-Y-E-R.
Hi.
Yes.
No, the other side. Chuck.
Okay. Sorry, I was trying to get
Yeah, let's get together after.
So Chuck Kim is here.
Yes.
I have a grill.
Okay.
Right here, there's right here.
Gotcha.
Right here, is, you're going to start at 10:30, and you're set on it. So,
okay.
If you want to
grab.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking for. I'm looking for me.
Well, if she's not there, I'll go over there.
Okay. It's almost a year.
Okay, I'll go over there.
All right.
And I'll take my stuff. There's a glass of water that was mine.
Okay.
I have a drink out of this one, so you can have it.
All righty.
Yes.
Steve is back, so he's a good time person.
Oh, good. Thank you.
So I'm going to move the glass of water so it's right there, and I'm going to take my stuff, and I'll go over there. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. I can wear several hats.
You're so good. And we tried to separate out all the
I know.
Is in the order.
Yeah.
To get
I know. All right, thank you. Love you. And Chuck Young is to your left, Mika.
Awesome.
Hi, Chuck.
This is Mika Wright.
I have questions for you.
All right. Afterwards, or?
Yeah. Ooh, let me raise this up. Let's see. All right, if we can all start making our way to our seats and get settled down, because we are about to start this next session. Hey, I'm running the show. So, we will get started in just 1 second here. All right, how many of you are enjoying things thus far? Yeah, that's what I like to hear. All right, so my name is Mika White, and I am Second Vice President of the Washington Council of the Blind. And this is, we're now in session, and we're going to go ahead and get started right now. We're going to get started with a door prize.
Testing. All right. I am here, and so Mika and I switched places. So we have a $25 gift certificate for Subway from South Kitsap, Council of the Blind. And the winner is Rhonda Nelson. Are you in the room? Nope. Okay, I'm going to draw another name. Shout out if you win, because you should be excited. Galen Floyd is not in the room, so I'm going to go again. Joanne Hunter is not here yet, so I'm going to go again.
Keep going.
Sorry. I'm doing really good, aren't I?
At least I can read them. Donald Moberg, I don't believe is in the room, so I'm going to go again. Well, I know he's an vendor. Okay. Byron Kazmarski, are you in the room? Nope, he's at exhibit.
It pays to get back here on time.
Okay. The next one is, and I'm reading it upside down. Oh, okay. No, Greg Vickers, he's in, yep. Rex Ransom, are you in the room? No.
Oh, goodness.
I'm going to find everybody that's not here, right? Okay, John Bechtel. John Bechtel? No? Okay. We do have a lot of people here, really, I promise. Colette Arvidsson? Arvidsson, yes,
oh,
Colette,
yes.
You won.
And when they are here, they make sure that we know that they're here, because we'll skip over that name. Can you raise your hand there? There you go. All right, thank you. And you guys, let's give a warm welcome to ACB Radio's listening this morning. So thank you, ACB Radio. Okay, so our next speaker, we're going to learn about the Hadley School for the Blind. How many of you are familiar with Hadley? Awesome. Okay, more than just distance learning. And the person that's going to speak to us about that is Charles Young, and he is the president. Please help me give him a great big WCB welcome.
It's up here.
Well, greetings, everybody. It's great for me to be back in the Pacific Northwest. Some of you may know that in my prior life, I was the administrator of the Oregon Commission for the Blind for 21 years, and I worked alongside of Paul Jajic and Shirley Smith and Laoma, and all those are all colleagues that were state agency directors, my counterparts in Washington when I was in Oregon, and I think some of them are going to be back here today. So I'm glad to be back here. But for the last 10 wonderful years, I've been the president of the Hadley School for the Blind in Winnetka, Illinois, which is a affluent suburb, if you will, of Chicago. And those who are not familiar with the Hadley School for the Blind, it came about 95 years ago when William Hadley, a public school teacher who had been blind in one eye in a childhood archery accident, suddenly, at the age of 55, had a detached retina in his good eye, and he became blind overnight. And he was a very educated man, and he spoke three languages. And at this time, 1915, there really isn't any much of any programs for adult onset of blindness. All the 50 states have schools for the blind, but there's not much for adults at that time. So William Hadley taught himself Braille. And somebody said to him one day, well, you're a teacher and you taught yourself Braille. Why don't you help other similarly situated adults who have lost their vision as adults? Which is about 75% of the people who are blind in the world become blind as adults. So he wrote letters to the schools for the blind and asked if there was a need for somebody to teach newly blinded adults. And the first response was from a housewife in Kansas who had become blind, and she wanted to be a role model for her three-year-old daughter and show mom could learn to read. And so we call her the first desperate housewife. And William Hadley made up handwritten lessons and sent them to her through the mail using the provision in the postal code, Free Matter for the Blind. So we became a correspondence school for visually impaired and blind people. And when you don't have to pay postage as a correspondence school, it gives you a little bit of an advantage. That was our beginning. One student in 1920 when we became a correspondence school. And all the community of Winnetka, at that time the housewives didn't work. Everybody rallied around William Hadley, and the housewives all learned Braille, or not all, many of them did. And they made up these handwritten textbooks and what have you. And from its inception, Hadley has been free. That's done a lot with volunteer labor and what have you. So fast forward today, we now have 10,000 students in over 100 in 10 countries, and we're in all 50 states. And we have as few as 35 students in Wyoming and Alaska studying with us, and we have as many as 700 currently studying with us from Florida, which is our biggest user. And interesting enough, we have 35 students in Hong Kong, so they parallel, because Hong Kong is largely English-speaking part of the world. So that's kind of the inception of the Hadley School for the Blind. I want to talk to you about a few changes in the Hadley School for the Blind, but before I do, I want to get back to my roots. I went to college at the University of Wisconsin-Stout and got a degree in vocational rehabilitation, and I didn't know a blind person and had never really recalled meeting any. And I took a job sight unseen at the Oregon Commission for the Blind, and I came in here as a work evaluator, and that's a person who administers tests to try to determine what you might be best suited for in employment. And I also had a shop background, so I was the shop teacher at the Oregon Commission for the Blind and taught wood shop. And again, and they picked three bright young blind people who were all totally blind, and they came in at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they stayed at 5, and so did I. And they taught me how to teach them wood shop, if you will. And all this testing that I had in my background, all these psychological profiles, and that was absolutely worthless. It had no validity with people blind that wasn't accessible. And so I thought, since I was a psychometrist and a tester, but I would devise my own test that blind people could administer to sighted people. And so if you'll indulge me a little bit, I wrote up this profile. Notice I call it a profile, not a test. And that's semantics, because you can flunk a test, but you can't flunk a profile. So it's less threatening. But the first question was, when did you first realize you're sighted? How did you feel? Is sightedness hereditary? Do you consider yourself well adjusted to this condition? Were you forced to go to a school for the sighted, and how long does it take to learn print? How do sighted people eat, decide what color to wear, and find the restroom? How do you do housework, and what kind of cooking are sighted people able to do? Do you ever have trouble understanding people because they refer to things that you have not experienced? What are the interests of a sighted person? Do you wonder how you sound to others? What special problems does being sighted present? Have you ever wished you could not see? Do you have trouble making friends with people who are not sighted? That's an occupational hazard in my business. Does sightedness make it difficult to take care of children and bring them up properly? How do you feel when you fill out applications and have nothing to put down where it says disabilities? Do you think that being sighted makes it hard for you to face life? Are you ever a blind person in your dreams? Do blind people ever turn aside and whisper when you walk in the room? Then I would close with something really nice, like, thank you for completing this profile. The authors think you must have great courage to face life as a sighted person. Now, keep in mind, how people respond to this depends on whether they're born sighted or they're sighted by accident. And then I put them in categories, you know, at the end of the profile. And there's the mildly sighted, and this is the label we'll give them, probably the easiest group to get along with. They generally accept and often even respect the opinions of others, including people with disabilities. And then there's the moderately sighted, probably the most common and largest group. They can be brought to understand the feelings and views of others, including blind people, but they are usually more interested in their own issues. And then there's the severely sighted. Fortunately, minority, but they know everything, especially what's good for blind youth and adults. Although there's no quick or easy cure for severely sightedness, they can be helped by counseling. But remember, they must really, really want to change. And worst of all, I discovered there are a few profoundly sighted. These people are usually heads of major bureaucracies. The profoundly absolutely know everything and will never change unless you beat them up real badly politically. But even then, you can't trust them. So that was my profile I wrote as a tester. I wrote that back in the 90s, and Shirley Smith heard it, and she said, "Can I have your permission to share that with the Washington Council of the Blind when I speak this weekend?" I said, "I'd be happy to." So if some of you might have remembered it, and it was later, it was published in the Braille Forum, but I loaned that to Shirley. So brings back my fond memories of the Pacific Northwest. So let me get back to Hadley. Hadley teaches Braille by mail and still does to this day. We started out as adult continuing education. We have all manner of curriculum for adults who are visually impaired and blind. And each of our courses comes with a qualified instructor who responds back to your homework assignments and what have you. And you can study with us in large print, in Braille, in audio, and now on the Internet, and what we call eHadley. And the next program we developed was the family education program, and we opened up the school to some of our courses, and we developed some curriculum for the parents of blind babies and infants. And they can also take the parents and siblings of blind people can also enroll free in our Braille curriculum. And we have something like 13 different Braille courses. Now we have more. We just added UEB, so there's even more of that. You know, so when you count abacus and all manner of Braille courses. And then somewhere along the line, we developed a high school program for people who are, and this is for blind people only, not the sighted family members or spouses. It's for people, for whatever reason, didn't graduate from high school or invited to complete their high school education with us. And we give them credit for any studies they did with their local high school or what have you. And we take them, and do a plan with them to give them the a series of courses to complete their high school curriculum. Every year, we have somebody in their 80s or 90s that graduated. With after they're retired, they have the time to go back to school, and we get a lot of younger people who are deafblind because it's so frustrating sometimes to be deafblind and try to get accessible curriculum and what have you. So we get a lot of deafblind students in their late teens and early 20s at the school. And then we developed the Hadley School for Professional Studies, and this is for people who work with visually impaired and blind people, whether it's in the school district or if they're a bus driver to school for the blind or a volunteer at the Lyons Center for the Blind or whatever. If you consider yourself having a professional capacity working with blind people, whether it's paid or not, volunteer or not, you can enroll in our Hadley School for Professional Studies, and we have all manner of courses on teaching the teachers to work with visually impaired and blind people. And again, most of our stuff is free. It's always free for people who are visually impaired and blind, and there's some tuition on a few of our courses for the professionals who are doing this for their living. Now, for what's new at Hadley, we recently added UEB, Unified English Braille Code, as has been accepted by the North American BANA, the Braille Authority of North America. And so we wanted to gear up to have first a transition to UEB for experienced Braille users. This is not starting out in UEB. This is people who have already been very comfortable with the Braille code and want to learn the transition to UEB. And we launched, I think, the second week in January, and already we've had 2,500 students enroll in that course. And many of them have completed it and gone on to take the certification exam to be UEB instructors. And we're getting rave reviews on the UEB course. And I took, because we got so many enrollments, I took all six of my Braille instructors and moved them over to teaching transition. And we suspended many of the other Braille courses because they're in the old code. And this gives us a year to revise those courses into the new code. So we'll come coming out this January with the traditional Braille courses for new learners, but they'll be UEB compatible. Another very popular new event is we introduced Braille music here about a year ago, and we've had a plethora of students enrolled in Braille. And within that, they're especially on stringed instruments and piano and the different, I'm not musical, but all the different instruments, and there's different Braille courses that specialize in that type of instrument. Because there is a tsunami of people heading our way with age-related low vision, and I use those words very seriously, because these people, fortunately, are not going to be blind in the classic sense of totally blind, but they're going to have significant, uncorrectable vision loss, and they perceive themselves as low vision, but they have some usable vision, and they'll have that vision up until the day they die, usually. And so that's that. And so we've created a new program that's specifically designed for this audience of 55 and over with low vision. It's called the Low Vision Focus at Hadley. It has its own website, and everything on the website and all of our courses and curriculum that pertains to low vision is there, as well as on our regular website. But we want these people to be able to identify with the particular curriculum. And we have 10 modules or audio lessons that they can download on their computer, or we can send them in the library format, the Library for Blind format, the 10 audio lessons, or they can get it from us in CD. And it's these lessons on how to, adapt the kitchen for low vision, or how to go out to eat for going out to dinner, and different tips, or personal care, or marking and everything. And we have these 10 audio lessons, and the beauty of them is you can study them in the privacy of your own home, with or without loved ones or caregivers or adult children or what have you. That's your decision. Sometimes the loved one is better sent to the other room to give you, leave you alone, so you can do, not try to tell. Oh, you're going to get burnt, or you're going to, and otherwise, some of people are good at this, and now we're in the process of making companion videos. So not only do we have the audio lesson, but you'll have a video that you can see this, and you can enlarge it on your cell phone, what have you. But also your family member, your caregiver, or loved ones, and that can see how you do these things, so you can educate your family members and people in your environment, and also they can be your eyes in case you there's something you might have missed there. And you can keep these and go back, refer back to them over and over and over again, and use them as you see fit. And they make great programs for peer support groups, and the peer support groups have been usually successful with visually impaired and blind adults with adult onset. And we have two courses on how to set up and manage a peer support group. So if you've ever thinking about starting one in your area, we have two free courses you can take on how to set up a peer support group. But, if you set up this peer support group in a rural community or what have you, and you get your local optometrist speak and you get your local ophthalmologist speak, then what do you do for a program for the rest of the year? So these make great program. You play these audio lessons, and then the people discuss them in a group, and a lot of times they come up with even more creative ideas to do everyday things. So you can discuss these audio lessons. There's one on medications and how to mark medications when you're low vision, so you don't harm yourself, if you will. We have a whole series on independent living and curriculum now on independent living. And I don't know if I mentioned before, but I have 35 teachers that work for Hadley, and only one of them comes to the headquarters building to work, and the other 34 work from home, and they're sprinkled all over the country. Well, I think your president said she just took the UEB course, and we had Sue Melrose as her teacher, who's down in Los Angeles. But I have a minister in Boston who teaches our two chess courses, and then he also teaches our Bible course that's given to us by a religious. But he's a minister by day and a Hadley instructor of chess, and also of our religious curriculum at night. And it's interesting, of the people who used to play chess by mail, where they mail their moves back and forth, now they by email. And of the 100 most prolific email chess players in the United States, the top 10, I think 8 or 9 of the top 10 are Hadley graduates. So While my high school doesn't have a football team, and that I got one hell of a chess team I can put out there to take you on, if you will. The next I want to mention, seminars at Hadley. Have any of you been involved with that program? Well, we've got a few out there. Yeah. Okay. What we have done is we do internet webinars where we get a guest speaker, a content expert, and we put them online, and they'll make usually about a 20-minute presentation of their subject matter, and then we'll take questions from the audience. And if people have a microphone on their computer, they can ask their question or audibly. If not, they can email in their question, and then the presenter responds to this. And we've had some dynamite subjects on there, everything from blinded veterans and post-traumatic stress to my favorite. We have a blind fisherman, and I can't think of his name now, in Canada, who enters fishing tournaments all over the country, and he has his own collapsible boat that somebody hauls on the top of the roof of their car, and he has GPS and all manner of adaptions on this, and he talks about how to tie all these fishing knots using your teeth and your tongue and your fingers. And I'm a fisherman, and I know how we use our teeth and hold the line while we're doing this stuff. And this guy talks about, if you're not getting snagged when you're out there fishing, you're not getting snagged, you're not going to catch any fish, because if there's nothing to snag on, there's no fish there. They're in the weeds and the trees trimming. And so he says, and it's just delightful to hear him talk about all these techniques. And we've had a lot of cooking seminars that people are interested in. We do holiday cooking and, making turkey at Thanksgiving and tax talk during, in April, when we get close to April. But there's all manner of subjects, and the beauty is we put them on our website and archive them. So if you didn't hear them live, you can go back in and listen for free without any paperwork, no hubbub. Just go on our website and go through there's like 300 topics on there, and there's travel and all manner of things, eye conditions, eye diseases, business, a lot of business curriculum. And that brings me to the next subject. We launched the Foresight Center for Entrepreneurship a few years ago, and that was a particular interest of mine. All the VR agencies, the commissions for the blind, have employment programs and assistance in the 50 states, if you will. But very few of them are doing much in the area of self-employment and entrepreneurship. And there's a disproportionate number of people with significant disabilities that are in self-employment, and I think that's partly because they have trouble getting employment, so they go out on their own and create their own businesses. So the Foresight Center is business curriculum written by successful blind entrepreneurs, specifically for people who are visually impaired and blind entrepreneurs, and we're very, very proud of that program. I have about 700 people, and the signature course is self-employment on a minimal investment. And when I say minimal, I don't mean the amount of time you put in. That's the minimal amount of cash that you put into it. So, but there's little modules, one lesson modules on marketing and finance and all manner of things to create business. And I've taken many of the courses myself, and I'm very excited about those. And as extension of the Foresight Center for Entrepreneurship, and Rick Foresight and his wife Sandy, he's a blind businessman that owned Foresight Industries in Chicago until he sold it to his employees for bazillions of dollars a few years ago, is one of the signature partners. And then the other one is Bernie Newcomb, who was from the Oregon, SIO Oregon, who went to the Oregon School for the Blind and went on to Oregon State and didn't have much luck with his business degree getting a job when he finished college. So he and another fellow went off and launched their own business. And you may know it. It's called E-Trade. And was the first online trading. And I don't know how much money he made, but I know when he sold it about 15 years ago, he wrote out a check to Oregon State for $8 million. He's been funding our Foresight Center and business school. So we got some pretty successful blind businessmen that have helped help support this program. And this May 19th, we're going to launch our first ever blind business venture competition. And we're going to invite blind people from around the country, around the world, as long as they've taken one or two Hadley courses or modules, even by Valentine's Day. That's February 15th is the deadline to submit your business idea to us. And we're going to have celebrity judges, you know, not unlike the Shark Tank. Only these are people that know about business. And we're going to review these, and we're going to award a cash of prizes. The total amount of money is going to be $25,000 that was given to us by Bernie Newcomb. And we're going to divide that between two or three businesses, depending on their need and the compelling case that they make in their business plan. So I hope you folks that ever wanted to flirt with the idea of a business. We encourage the Randolph Shepherd vendors to participate, but it has to be an idea outside the Randolph Shepherd vending program, because that's the state's responsibility to fund. So I'm not interested in funding any Randolph Shepherd programs, but if a blind vendor wants to open up their own laundromat or something that's outside the state federal building and that and has nothing to do with their I'm open to entertain that, you know, if it's a business idea separate. Finally, I want to mention that I have brochures in large print and Braille, and they're at the ACB exhibit booth. It's the first table on your right when you head into the exhibit area. And they're large print and Braille copies. The first one I'll mention is What's Happening at Hadley, and it talks about all the newest and latest things. And the next one is on our iFocus program, and I'll give you a little thumbnail sketch of that. But this has been an extraordinarily successful program. But our instructor, who happens to work out of, I believe it's Tennessee, Doug Walker, is a iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch connoisseur. And he has recorded a plethora of YouTube videos on how to use all the accessible features on the iPhone, iPad, and the Apple Watch. And he puts up about one or two a week, and he records them in his home, and all you ever see is his hands and the iProduct. You never see him. And he reminds me of Mr. Rogers. Very calm and talks. And I have a student of ours who is a university professor and a doctorate degree, and she loves his iFocus videos and on the iProduct. She says, "But he does repeat himself, Chuck." And I said, "Uh-huh." And then she goes, "But that's good teaching technique, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, it's done intentionally when he repeats himself." So I go to the Apple Store periodically. They have lessons on Tuesday night to learn how to use the features, not the accessible feature, but just the features on my iPhone and my iPad. And by the time I get to the parking lot, I forgot three-fourths of what they showed me. Okay? So I learned there's a much better way to do this. Go to Hadley and click on where it says videos and go down. There's a whole series of videos. And not only do they tell you, but you can watch and see. And if you want to use some friends. And the teachers in the schools are using these because a lot of times they've never been taught this and they've got visually impaired and blind students. And so you can watch all the videos that you want and learn about all the accessible features of the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. And I think my time has expired. And I thank you very much. And it's wonderful to be back in the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you so very much. You guys, give him another warm welcome. Thank you. Okay, so apparently there was a Bluetooth headphones that were found on the table last night. I guess somebody was having a little too much fun in hospitality there. So if you can tell Frank the brand name that it is, you will get it back. Okay. It doesn't.
Is Tim here?
What's that, Glenn? Oh, it was left here in the board meeting. Okay. Is Tim Joyce in the room? Awesome. Could you come to the front? Okay. So we are going to be talking about growing a fragrant garden. I need this lesson because I have the black thumb of death. My friend asked me to plant sit for her, and I forgot that I was plant sitting. And then she says, I'm coming to get my plant. And I was like, oh, you are? Oh, let me go check on the plant that I forgot, and it was dead. So, and anything that I have tried to grow has died. So, so I'm hoping that there a miracle will happen this morning. So, to learn about growing a fragrant garden in the Pacific Northwest, please help me give a warm WCB welcome to Tim Joyce. He's a meteorologist for Tribune Television Northwest. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, everybody. Everybody hear me? All right. Excellent. Watering plants always usually helps. That's usually a key component.
Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
That's the number one tip. Water, sun, soil helps too. Thanks for having me out here today, guys. Appreciate it. Get these notes working for me. My name is Tim Joyce. I'm a meteorologist with Tribune Television Northwest. We have three stations in the Pacific Northwest. Q13 here in Seattle, home of the Seahawks. Yeah! Joe TV, also on the television as well, and that's the home of the Sounders. And also Portland CW32, which isn't really home of anything except a couple of wacky shows and some programming meant for people about 15 to 35. Been a meteorologist for about 15 to 20 years here in the Northwest, so I'm kind of know more about the microclimates. And I got kind of late in the game to becoming a gardener. I took the Master Gardener classes through Portland State, their extension office. So it was about 11 weeks of pretty intensive classes, and then it ended up being a whole year of basically answering phone calls from folks just asking regular gardening questions and me holding the phone and going, I have no idea what the answer is. But then over the course of the year, they teach you where to look up the answers. And so that's one of the reasons why I was kind of excited about this particular project of how to grow a fragrant garden in the Northwest, because most of what I focused on was permaculture, which is the kind of a growth usually with perennial plants that come back year after year and the kinds that are edible in your garden. And permaculture also lends to plants sort of feeding one another. So one might take nitrogen from the soil, one puts back nitrogen in the soil. So that's sort of where my focus was. So this is a sort of a new way to explore different parts of the gardening world and to help you guys out in growing perhaps a fragrant garden. Most everyone impressed with the Master Gardener thing, but of course I know now that it's not as impressive as I thought it was originally. It just tells me how to look up the resources so I can look up. Oh, well, thank I won. One person is impressed. That's good. So I'm a weather geek and an aspiring plant nerd, and so maybe by the end of this you will be also at least one of the above. We'll kind of hit on a little bit about the weather here in the Northwest, because that's optimal, of course, to grow plants, both indoors and out, because you've got to have some sunlight even in those places inside to grow the plants. And then we'll touch on some suggestions for some plants that I think are a little more on the fragrant side. And there's so many to choose from. I kind of had to narrow the focus down one. And also there's different variability in people's gardening expertise. So I'll give a couple suggestions that might seem a little obvious and some that might seem not so obvious. And one of the things I came across when I was sort of starting on this project is sort of understanding about, you know, how the experience is in my own yard, my own garden, and to paraphrase the idiom, beauty is in the nose of the beholder, because there's so many great smells out there. The fragrance in the air when the rain is almost there, and then that smell right after a big thunderstorm, I mean, those are like my personal favorites. So I thought I'd talk a little about the science of that, because I'm a little more of a weather expert than I am about a gardening expert. But lightning comes along and rips apart molecules of nitrogen and oxygen in the atmosphere, and then oxygen is never lonely for very long. So ozone is the key component in that really good fresh rain smell that comes after that. The average human nose can pick up the distinctive smell of ozone, and I bet you guys are better than average when it comes to smelling things like ozone. I think it's 10 parts per billion, and ozone, while it's close to the earth, can be hazardous to humans in large quantities. Don't worry about after a thunderstorm. It's not nearly enough to harm anybody out there. Just get out there and enjoy it. Fun fact, ozone comes from the Greek word ozean, and I took French and Russian. I didn't take any Greek, so hopefully my pronunciation is decent. And that actually means to smell. Of course, Greeks also coined the term meteorology, which has zero to do with meteors. Meteor in Greek comes from anything that falls from the sky, and then mostly they meant different kinds of precipitation. The other pleasant smell associated with the rain is that deep, earthy smell that comes after the rain falls. That is strongest after a dry spell, which, of course, this summer we got a real big taste of on both sides of the Cascades, especially on the east side, if you could get over the smoky, hazy smells. The earthy smells come from two origins, soil microbes and the plants themselves. The microorganisms in the soil produce spores over long, dry spells. But the spores aren't what you're actually smelling. When the plants actually, scientists have discovered that the chemicals excreted during the production of those spores is called geosmin. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. Ozone has nothing on geosmin. Ozone, as I mentioned, 10 parts per billion. Humans can smell geosmin only 5 parts per trillion. It's a lot of zeros, a lot of zeros. Fun fact, geosmin is what beets give that unique earthy taste to those vegetables. Very distinctive. If you love beets, people who love them or hate them, it's like cilantro. Now, in city environments, you'll likely notice those ozone smells more after a rain. And in the country areas, you'll notice a little more of the geosmin smells in those areas. And if you're kind of in the suburbs, you'll probably smell a mix of kind of both, which is sort of where I live in the Seattle area. Plants releasing various oils, the other reason why it smells so awesome after and during a rain, and when it rains, certain chemicals that make up the oils in the plants get released into the atmosphere, usually along with that geosmin that cause that familiar and inviting scent. Now, if you're going to grow a fragrant garden, you've got to understand the weather here in the Northwest, which can be pretty fickle, but there are ways to sort of know what's coming. And a couple things, because it's all about microclimates here around here. So each and every little nook and cranny has its own sort of weather patterns. Geography plays a huge part. We are very blessed in the Northwest. We do have an incredibly mild climate. Most everything you'd like to grow will probably grow here with a little bit of help. And we're also able to have some seasons despite the mild weather. Geography plays a huge part. Salem, Oregon, for example, exactly halfway point between the equator and the true North Pole. So we have days in the summer, very, very long sunset, almost till 10 p.m. here in Seattle, and nights in the winter that start very, very early. In fact, I think sunset, our shortest day of the year, is around 4:15 in the afternoon, so definitely short days. Topography, that plays a lot in terms of gardening, how our land is formed. It can also play a role in how the plants will grow. In these microclimates, local terrain can sharply modify the climate within any area. South-facing slopes, for example, they can get affected by more solar heat than flat land or land facing the north-facing slopes, which are the hardest to grow things on. Slopes also affect the airflow around the plants. Warm air rises, cold air sinks. And the microclimates also exist within every single garden as well. All else being equal, garden beds on the south side of one of those east-west walls, for example, much warmer than garden beds on the north side of that very same wall. Hillsides are never as cold in the winter as the hilltops above them or the ground below. They're often called thermal belts, and that's actually where some of our best grape production here is in the Pacific Northwest. Lowland areas into which cold air flows are called cold air basins. You'll find these around Everett, around Olympia. Cold air basins are usually about several degrees colder than surrounding communities. So if you're in those areas, you really have to watch out and protect some of those sensitive plants outside. On the big scale here in western Washington, we're wedged between the biggest ocean on the whole planet, of course, the Pacific, and some pretty tall mountains. Those are the Cascades. Tallest one, Mount Rainier, about 14,000 feet. And the limiting factor to any growing season is the cold, because cold will kill plants. The flow of our part of the Pacific, it comes from Alaska down to California. It's called the California Current. Keeps those oceans chilly, but at least it keeps the hurricanes away. So that is good news for us. Pacific might be cold if you want to swim in it, but actually water holds heat way better than air does. And the ocean holds an average temperature around here in about the 50s. That means when the air gets colder than the water usually functions to actually warm up the air. So the closer you are, say, to the Puget Sound, the longer your growing season can be. Coldest source of air here comes from Canada, and the Rocky Mountains and the Cascade Mountains block a lot of the huge Arctic outbreaks that affect the Great Plains and places like Chicago and New York and Boston, which was just buried in all that snow last year. So there's only a couple places where the cold air can actually sneak through the mountains and affect areas in western Washington. One of those is the Columbia River Gorge. The other one is the Fraser River Valley in southern British Columbia. So if you're near that area around, say, western Whatcom County near Bellingham and Blaine, you know when those winds start howling out of the east that you're going to get a real blast of some cold air. And because the gorge is more than a mile wide, it's basically like leaving your freezer door open in the winter. Folks, anyone here? A little raise of hands. Anyone in Southwest Washington? Anyone like Kalama? There's one in the corner. We are talking about some cold temperatures in that area because of those strong east winds that come out of the gorge and really affecting the weather in the Portland metro and around Vancouver, Washington. This week, for example, on Wednesday, it was 29 degrees in Battleground, Washington. Yeah, it's early November. That same morning, the low was a full 10 degrees warmer here at SeaTac. That difference can be the difference between life and death for your plants. When water freezes, it expands. When that water expands inside the plant cell, especially of a non-woody plant, it can burst the cell wall. So when it thaws, because you seem like the plants, you're like, oh, it looks, it seems pretty fine. It's going to be all right. But when it thaws, you notice that it becomes this mucky, murky mess, and that plant is pretty much done for, except for, of course, the compost bin, which you should all compost our dead plants. The first and last frost dates, they have been changing over the course of the last 15 to 20 years. Frost dates are about a month to a week earlier in the spring. They're about a week to a month later in the autumn as well. Now, about 10 years ago in Portland and Vancouver, for example, the average last spring frost happened around early April. The last few years, it's happened in early March. Bellingham in 2010, the last freeze date was May 5th. Last year it was March 8th. Olympia and the South Sound, one of the colder regions around the Puget Sound, in 2010, the last freeze was May 19th. Last year it was March 10th. Wow. So they are changing a little bit. Seattle here, at least at SeaTac, the last freeze last year was March 3rd. In 2008, it was April, but for several years in the 2000s, the last freeze date happened in February. So we are seeing a bit of a shift in that. It just goes to show that while we are seeing changes in our climate, nature works by back and forth extremes. It just, the extremes just start getting a little more extreme. To give you a little working definition, weather tells you whether it's going to rain today or tomorrow. Climate tells you what it's going to be in December or next May or next June. So they are similar, but they're different. Usually climate is an average of about 30 years. So as we go further in time, we start seeing the climate shifting in many, many ways. That takes us on to the plants. Now, I picked, there's so many to choose from, really, when it comes to plants. I did pick a couple favorites for each particular season, because I think a garden can be pleasing pretty much every single season around the year. I want to look at a variety of plants and flowers, looked at a bunch of different recommendations. I avoided HGTV. Everything there was for the Southeast and the East Coast. Sunset Magazine was particularly helpful because they have climate zones based specifically on the Pacific Northwest. And I sorted other periodicals that I have in my library. But a lot of them, I wanted to give you recommendations that would, of course, do well here in Washington and the greater Pacific Northwest. Fall is the time of some changing seasons, so we'll start out with autumn. The smell of rain returning and harvesting for a lazy gardener like myself. This is the best time of year to plant things because then you're guaranteed pretty much a source of water on again, off again. So if you happen to forget for a little while, I'm not really pointing fingers towards Mika here. Just, you know, just saying, nature provides, nature provides. The promise of rain is pretty much right around the corner every couple of days. So you still can find some fragrant plants. So I picked a couple of ones. Two actually for fall that most people probably wouldn't think of. One called Osmanthus or Osmanthus, depending on your preference. It's a member of the holly family, but it has this really sweet smell. It's also shade tolerant, which helps in the Northwest. And it grows in a shrub and has foliage kind of all year round. And I actually consider, well, at least when I'm successful at gardening stuff, I always consider roses a fall flower because everyone thinks of it during the spring, but actually I've had roses bloom in the Northwest as late as November, and there are some varieties that do smell better than others, and of course some have thorns that are bred out of them as well for safer handling. In the winter, a good old standby is rosemary. Not only is it my grandmother's name, but rosemary is amazing, and it grows very well here in the Northwest. Small evergreen shrub and the pine-like leaves just have a wonderful scent. It grows wild in lawns, gardens, parkways all over town here in Seattle. It's edible, and I think it's personally delicious. Rosemary can be planted in any season, pretty much except for the summer, when it's just too hot and takes too much water to stay alive. Kind of fast-forwarding a little bit towards the late end of winter and the first part of spring, and a couple of the first earliest bloomers, star magnolias. I think they're amazing. I had one of these trees in my house when I lived in Portland. I remember one year a random February snowstorm knocked every single one of the blossoms off the tree. It was kind of sad, but that's what happens sometimes with those early bloomers. The scent is kind of subtle with a hint of citrus. They like sun or part shade, and the time to plant them is actually right about now. Jasmine has a sweet and floral scent. It's also one of those late winter, early spring bloomers. I've smelled this one a couple times personally. I've been told, though, that to some people it smells like a warm Hawaiian night, which sounds pretty nice in the early part of spring and late winter. It's a climbing vine, so it grows up to 20 feet, and it grows well in big pots and hanging baskets. Full sun, light shade, does pretty well. Now, spring is easy. I mean, everything smells awesome in the spring. Rebirth is everywhere. The obvious choice is lilac. It is among my absolute favorites. The scent, it's sort of spicy and sweet. It's really, to me at least, the essence of spring. The shrubs get about 6 to 8 feet high, and of course now is really a good time to plant them. They enjoy full sun if you're west of the Cascades or partial shade east of the Cascades because it's just so hot in that part of our state. And lilacs bloom best in regions that do have that winter chill. So actually, if you lived in California, you would not be able to enjoy lilacs as much as we do here in Washington. Mock orange, also one of my favorites in the spring. It's a shrub. The word mock, of course, which means that they smell like citrus, but you won't really getting any oranges out of these little bushes. They grow well west of the Cascades, and since several varieties don't have as strong of a scent, I'd actually recommend going to the nursery in the early spring and smelling the different varieties yourself. And then you can pick out which one you like the best. Jasmine's not necessarily edible. I mean, a lot of things you can eat. I've never tried to eat it. I don't think it's toxic to humans or dogs, but I don't know if it'd be very tasty. It's a good question. Maybe I'll try in the spring. I'll check it out. There is jasmine tea, so it must be on some tea. Get a thumbs up, yeah. Also with mock orange, pruning is best done right after they flower. They love well-drained soil, and they do blossom better the more sun that they have. Reasonably drought-tolerant, though, after they're actually established. On to summer, a couple suggestions there. Lavender, it sounds obvious, but it's been a mainstay of herb gardens many, many years. They flower prolifically, the foliage highly aromatic. They come back year after year. I mean, I have tried to kill lavender, and it just comes back, which I love it. Might be something for Mika. Could be something she could try. If her birthday's coming up, give her something in a potted plant. It is best grown outdoors, unfortunately, so have the potted plant on your patio or deck, and they do love direct sunlight. Once they're established, they are very, very light on your water bill, so incredibly drought-tolerant plants there. Lemon verbena, it isn't perfectly ideal here in the Northwest in the ground, but it works really well as a container plant. Can get a little tall, 6 to 8 feet tall, but the good news is luckily they love being trimmed back, and so the more you trim them back, the more they're going to blossom, which means the more they're going to smell. And the leaves is what releases their fragrance every time they're touched. This is a great plant.
Is that the lemon balm?
Not the lemon balm. Lemon balm is a little bit different. It gets a little bit lower to the ground, okay. But also a pretty amazing one as well. On the verbena, though, it's really good for high traffic areas, doors, hallways, where people just accidentally brush by them, so the fragrance just keeps on going. For optimal odor and oils, it does well in direct or bright sunlight. Otherwise, it just spends most of its energy with the vines trying to look for the direct sunlight. So if you just put it in direct sun, it ends up spending most of the energy on producing leaves that are fragrant and amazing. This is actually an edible plant as well. The leaves can be laid out and dried, can be used in tea, desserts, even as seasoning in meat dishes. Although, I don't know how I would care for lemony meat, but hey, some people might like that. Lemon chicken. Okay, lemon chicken. All right, that's one for lemon chicken. Drainage is the key with this sweet lemon-flavored plant. Doesn't like to be overly wet, so well-drained soil, always a pretty good component there. And when temperatures dip to about 40 degrees, lemon verbena, like much of us, would prefer to be inside. So bring that on inside and near a sunny window. I mean, I could name thousands of other plants that have amazing smells. Basil, mint family, thyme, dill, flowering plum. And I've always been pretty partial to the smells of leaves of a tomato plant. Fairly simple. Just crush it in your fingers. Just the simple things. That's what I really appreciate. Quick tips to bringing those scents inside. Best time to cut stems and branches early morning or evening when the air is cool and use sharp and clean pruners. On the shrubs, you want to cut those flowers that grow in clusters like lilacs and mock orange, for example. It's best before the buds have actually opened, so you get them in the house and then they open up and really fill up with so much beautiful fragrance. On trees, you want to clip branches when the buds just kind of feel like they're fattening up just above a growth bud and take care not to disfigure the tree. On vines, if you snip the stems of a flowering jasmine, for example, you remove the lowest leaves and blooms nearest to the cut. And to care for the cuttings, think about plunging all the branches and stems immediately into a bucket of warm water. That's one of the ways you sort of preserve the cut, because otherwise it'll heal up. And another thing you can do for the cuttings is after you cut them, bring them in the house, remove the lower leaves, And that's important because when you put the stems into some sort of water receptacle, a vase or a jar, if you put the branches with leaves on them, the leaves will start to rot. And that is not a pleasant smell. So if you just put the stem in there, it'll help suck up a little more of the moisture and stay alive longer. Another thing you can do is once you get them in the house, is sometimes those cuts will try to heal on the plants. And if you recut them a little closer, about a half inch to an inch, that can help it drink more water and last longer inside. So recutting those, especially woody plants, will help you. And changing the water and recutting the stems can make an arrangement and the fragrance last even longer. So the bottom line message is to get out there and garden. I want to thank you guys all for your time. And I have any questions? Any questions about weather or plants? I'm here and available.
Do you want to run a microphone?
Anyone want to run a microphone? Volunteers? Kind of fighting a head cold, so sorry if I'm a little stuffed up.
If somebody has a question, they could shout at you.
You can just shout it out too.
Hello.
I do not have anything to do with Cisco. He is I am an aspiring plant nerd. He is an official PhD qualified plant nerd extraordinaire. Cisco is amazing. No, he works for King 5, and I'm with Q13. So we're different TV stations, but we all like each other. At least that's what he says. I'm not sure. I like him. I don't know what he thinks about me. Yes, in the. Yes, name it.
What's your opinion about what the winter's going to be like?
This winter, it's a very good question. And this winter, I think, is going to be one of those classic El Niños. We've already seen El Niño is a weather pattern that happens. It's also called Southern Oscillation. And it has to do with warmer waters in the Pacific Ocean off of South America. And with that weather pattern, typically here in the Northwest, we see a drier winter and a warmer winter, which is great if you want to try gardening. In fact, I put out a whole bunch of extra starts this year trying to grow some spinach and some kale and what was the other one? Some sort of lettuce. I'm like, this year is going to be the year I'm going to grow something all year round. It is a little bit drier, and for folks that like to get up to the slopes for like tubing or skiing, it's not always the best for that. But last year was such a bad year in the mountains for snowpack that it can't be quite that bad 2 years in a row. Statistics say otherwise. So this year should be, even though we do have an El Nino year and it's typically drier, you still can have pretty strong rain events. So I would be prepared for some of those as well. But on average, though, it's a little bit drier than typical. So far, actually, this fall has been quite wet. We've seen, I think October had about 5 inches of rain and normal is about 3. So we're having a wet fall, but winter might actually start drying out as we get towards December and January. Yeah. And when it gets a little dry, it can also be clear at night. When it gets clear at night, it gets really cold in the morning. So frosty mornings in many spots also, which is always real tricky for folks trying to get around. It's very slippery and sliding. Question in the back.
I'm Nancy, and this is regarding weather. I know a weatherman named Nick Walker. Do you happen to know him?
Do you know where he works?
Atlanta, Georgia.
I do not know it, Nick Walker.
He was on 7 and 11.
It is a pretty small weather community. I mean, so we do know a lot of each other, but Nick Walker does not ring a bell. Although my middle name is Walker, so. I could just say that we're related, but.
Do you think we'll get any snow?
Oh, the million-dollar question, will we get snow? You know, snow happens here about every 3 years on average here in Seattle. And it's a possibility. Just the drier it is and the warmer it is, the likelihood is just less. So I'm going to say not this year. But I could be proven totally wrong. I know. But usually we have snow in the mountains. It's very, very close.
Joe,
of course. Make people, well, just as many people, though, if I said it's going to snow, just as many people would go, oh, no.
They don't count. Josette here from Vancouver, B.C. I have one comment and a question.
Yeah.
I found that giving my plants, well, in the apartment, I only grow two kinds of plants, and that's African violets and Christmas cactuses. But I'd like to also grow stuff on my deck in the future, too. Such as herbs and garden things, if I can get to that point. But I give my plants leftover tea, and I've always been told that's very good for them as well.
Yeah, and in fact, different kinds of tea, of course, probably would give you different results. But they call what's called compost tea, which is when you have a compost bin where it has, you can collect on the bottom. Like I had a worm bin, a sort of experiment I ran at my house in Portland, and the runoff from the worm bin was called compost tea. And that's particularly pretty intense, and so it can be almost too powerful for some container plants. But a little bit of tea is probably not going to hurt, depending if you put milk and sugar
but,
in your tea as
the
well.
The question I had about doing stuff on your deck, what kind of pots and stuff would you recommend for, you know, if you wanted to grow things like herbs and maybe a little bit of garden root?
I've had pretty good luck with any kind of... Any container can actually be used to grow stuff. I've seen people using old purses. I've seen people using old tennis shoes. Wacky things can be used to grow things. I usually go for, especially if I'm growing something that's going to be food related, to make sure that it's something that doesn't have any lead in it, because that's particularly bad. On my deck, I've just got these little concrete square planters. I've grown everything from, I grew strawberries in it 1 year. I even had a strawberry right around Thanksgiving. With things like that, though, you would have to watch out for container plants. The biggest problem growing things in containers is that they can be surrounded by cold air on all sides, and so the cold can really get at those things unless they're up against a really sunny wall. So you just kind of have to be careful about those days when it's going to be really cold and maybe thinking about moving them inside.
Have you ever used herb boxes?
Herb boxes. I did. I tried a vertical herb box on my deck. And it was just—it was hard to get—it's hard to get the water to flow all the way down. So the ones at the bottom seemed to always not quite do so well. They seemed really thirsty.
Oh, an earth box.
That's a good idea.
Oh,
I'll have to maybe I'll have to do a segment on that. I do the in the warm season on Q13, and for CW32, I do the garden segments on Fridays. So that's
I have
an
a
idea
question
for
you
for a segment. Good one.
Yeah, I have a question for you. This is Mika, also known as Plant Killer McDeath. So, I would like to know what kind of a low maintenance indoor plant that I, you know, I'm willing to water. I won't forget. I have an iPhone now, so I can just put a reminder in to water your plant. So,
a cactus.
Cactus is good.
Okay, I want something that smells good.
It's low maintenance and smells good. That's so. Oh,
or maybe mid maintenance. I can upgrade it to mid maintenance.
Let's see. Low maintenance and something that smells good. I'm trying to think of
maybe I need
a cactus with perfume.
Maybe I just need a Scentsy bar or something, some fragrant wax.
Yeah, I live in Eastern Washington, and one of the problems I have is I plant my tomatoes, and then they tell me a frost's coming. Mm-hmm. How is the best way to protect your plants once you plant them?
Once they're in the ground, it's a little more difficult. There's a couple different things, at least for tomatoes, because they're very temperature sensitive. I'm trying to remember the exact term for the product that people use, but they basically is like a little picture, sort of a rubber raft of sorts that you fill with warm water, and you kind of surround each plant. They're pretty labor intensive, but they do keep the ground particularly warm. If like you've got like a bunch of tomatoes that are about to ripen, and you've got this cold front coming in, and you're like, what's going to happen with these tomatoes? I totally was going to eat the heck out of these tomatoes, and now it's going to be cold. For those, you can also try to cover them with smaller plants. Take a 2-liter bottle, and you can sort of cut the top off of it, put it upside down on top of it. I was actually at my own place, have this raised garden bed. And raised garden beds also help a little bit because the ground temperature can be a little warmer if you lift up the soil just a touch. But covering those plants on those cold nights can also give them a longer lifespan as well. And if you're really desperate to get those tomatoes, you can actually cut them off at the base, dunk them in water, and bring them inside and hope, especially near a sunny window, that you can actually keep them going long enough for those tomatoes to ripen on the vine. Otherwise, you can learn how to make stuff with green tomatoes, which I did this year. Made a green tomato soup. It was really interesting.
I have a question.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law, he used some hanging tomatoes, like, they're like
The topsy turvies.
Yeah, and you know what? They made some pretty big tomatoes, and they were just hanging off the back porch. you know,
it's pretty awesome.
Edmonds. So, and also, I was wondering, is like mint or Sprague? I think it's called Sprague. Are those rum, obviously, right? And are they? Can you grow them in the house?
I think you can grow mint in the house. In fact, Mika, that might be something you want to try. Mint plants might be good for.
I'm
for
not hopeless day. After all. Yeah.
Okay, no, so, never so, hopeless, not at all.
So, what kind of mint garden could you? I mean, like not mint garden, herb garden. Can you do in your house?
You can grow pretty much most things. You can if you have a nice window with some southern light. That's because light's going to be the mitigating factor there. Okay. Is if you have you can grow pretty much. Most herb gardens can be done in a window garden kind of a setting.
What about an herbatorium? Could you
an herbatorium? That sounds very fancy. How would you define an herbatorium?
Well, it's like
a little tiny greenhouse for your countertop.
Like a fish tank.
Fish
tank with. Like
I think you could do that. And that especially would also increase the heat because a lot of particular herbs are also sort of warm appreciating kinds of plants. And a word on the topsy-turvy. I did a segment on the topsy-turvy about 2 or 3 years ago when I first got to Q13. And at the time, my experiment over the course of the summer did not go well. It did not hold the weight of the water and the plants really well, and it kind of shredded and fell apart. Since then, I think, I've contacted the company, and they've really improved the design of it. So I think people have better luck with the topsy-turvy, particularly that brand, because they've reinforced it so it can hold the weight of the soil and the water and the plants with the giant tomatoes or cucumbers and zucchinis. So.
Yeah, those tomatoes were huge.
Yeah.
So and we have time for, we're going to do two more quick questions.
What about Chia Pet? Chia Pet, the pottery that grows. Chia Pets, from what I remember from Chia Pets, and they've got all sorts of different sizes and shapes now, it's basically sprouts. You're growing sprouts. If you keep cutting the sprouts with scissors, you'll keep getting sprouts for your sandwiches, although I'm not sure about what kind of pottery it's grown on, because lead-based pottery would be a little bit of a concern for growing food, but it is the pottery that grows.
And I want to get somebody who has the microphone, please.
I have the microphone.
Thank you. Woo-hoo. Awesome.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I want to make sure. Okay.
This is Haley. I have a question about starting from seeds. I have a big picture window that I just had put in my kitchen, so it's got a pretty big ledge. If I wanted to grow herbs in that now, could I start them from seed?
I think you could. I'm also an optimist. I like to try things. In fact, I think I've learned more things from my gardening mistakes than from my successes. So in my window box, I just started from seed. Some radishes and what was the other thing I was growing? A little tiny butterhead lettuce. And okay. So I think, you know, you can, it doesn't hurt to try.
Okay. And the kale that's left in my garden from the summer, it still looks pretty good. Will it last for a while since it's more cold weather?
Kale's very hardy to about, I think, I want to say 25 or 27 degrees. It's good. It's one of those really good cold weather plants. So and actually, if it ends up snowing, so that would also make some people in this room very happy. snow actually provides a really good insulator. So kale can last pretty well. It was probably if there was a huge frost, let's say it got down to like 19 or 15 degrees, kale would be one of the things that would probably survive most of those cold weather outbreaks.
Okay, awesome. And I do my sprouts in a sprouting jar, growing them. So that's a good option, and it's easy for people too. Thank you.
Excellent.
And one more question.
To the far right.
It's one to my far right.
Far right.
And he's coming.
He's coming.
He's working. Go, Arnie, go.
Big room.
Yeah, it's a big room.
It is a big room.
Poor Arnold. I have a question actually about not the chia garden, not the chia plant, the chia pets, but the chia gardens. Do those work? Are those easy to grow in or? Do those usually work?
A lot of times I end up doing segments based on people having complaints about things. And so I haven't actually gotten any complaints about that. So I'm assuming that they work on some level, or at least people aren't disappointed because they're like, hey, Tim, what's going on with this? This didn't work. Why didn't it work? So if I'm not hearing complaints, it usually means that it might be a pretty good success story. And if anyone wants to email me any other questions, feel free. You can email me at the station. And Cindy can also give out my email as well if you don't have a pen and paper handy. But it's tim@q13fox.com.
And Tim, there's one more person that I heard that she's been trying to get it for a while. She's
at
the front
table.
the front table. It's
right,
Ann.
Right up in front, yeah.
Here we go. Okay.
I live in Yakima, and I have prolific raspberries for years, but I have no berries.
No berries.
Right.
Raspberries are one of those, they're a really interesting plant because they grow in sort of these 2 or 3 year cycles. And so what you want to do is actually to kind of stimulate them to grow, try pruning them back a little bit, and then they'll probably come back to life. So they have this 2 year cycle with raspberries.
They grow great. They grow beautifully.
It's when they think that they're threatened because there's animals chewing on them or because they're growing great now, but if they're probably old canes, so the new raspberries come up on the fresh canes that are coming up. So
I didn't ever get any.
Ever at all?
No.
Ooh. I would try
them 5 years at least.
I would try cutting them back almost all the way to the ground, and then I think you'll start getting some raspberries.
I do.
And with raspberries, you get usually two harvests. You'll get a first harvest in the spring, and then the next time when they regenerate, you'll get some in the fall as well. Oh, you're welcome very much. Thank you, guys. Appreciate you having me here. Get out and garden.
Thank you, Mika.
Well, we learned a lot about gardening and weather or what. I've learned there may even be hope for me. We get to grow stuff at work, so I might have to try this and not worry about getting mocked, so we'll see. Okay, is Kathy Gilman in the room?
Yes.
Could you come up here, please? And while she's doing that, I guess none of you won a door prize, right? I don't know. That didn't sound nearly as excited as I needed it to be. Thank you. All right. Are my door prize people ready?
Yes.
All right. Go for it. Tell us what you got and who you got. And be sure to talk in the mic.
Can you hear me?
Okay, now we can hear you.
Okay.
There you go, Lene.
Thank you. We have a nice can of cocoa for those cold mornings. And I forgot, $10 gift certificate from, is it just cash?
Yes.
Okay. South Kitsap Council of the Blind.
All right,
donation.
So cocoa and cash.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Who's going to win that?
And it looks like the big winner is Miriam Torres.
Miriam, are you here?
She's here.
All right, she's here. Oh, yay.
Oh, thank you. Sure.
Thank you very much, Lene.
You're welcome.
Oops. Okay, so this is something that I don't know that many of our, you know, we try to talk about it, but I don't know how many people know about this. So to learn more about it, we're going to talk about interest-free loans await you. Learn about the interest-free loan available to WCB members and other programs that are administered by the Washington Access Fund. To talk to us about that, please help me give a warm WCB welcome to Kathy Gilman.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for inviting me today. You're having quite a variety of topics today. Loans following gardening. That's great. I don't know. We have done, we did do a loan once for a lawnmower, so that kind of fits in. And so on my way in, I stopped at the exhibit area, and I saw lots of things on display. So some of the things there are kind of some of the things you might be interested in getting a loan for. So I'll explain a little bit about the program. I think a lot of you know that a lot of the assistive technology, the CCTVs and other, you know, reading devices can be quite expensive. And so the WCB has this great program in partnership with us to offer loans at 0% interest. And we've been doing that for years and are trying to get the word out. So the Washington Access Fund itself is an independent nonprofit. We serve Washington State, and we do all types of assistive technology loans for all types of disabilities. And we also have a business loan program. So if a person with a disability is interested in starting up a business or expanding an existing business, we can do a loan for business equipment or operating capital, something of that nature. So I thought I'd explain a little bit about how the loan program operates. We do have literature on a table in the exhibit area, so if you're interested in picking up a brochure, that's a good place to go. And then you can also check out our website. So the maximum amount in terms of what the WCB offers for a loan is $8,000. That's the maximum amount you can get at 0% interest. If you need a larger loan than that for more expensive technology, our agency in general considers loans up to $25,000. So that just means the amount above $8,000 would be at 5% interest, which is our regular interest rate for all other loans. And we don't have any fees at all. That's a nice thing about us as a nonprofit. There's no application fee. There's no fee to do the credit check or no fee to pay off the loan early, anything of that nature. So we do charge the 5% interest on the loans, but no fees. So in terms of applying for a loan, I'll just give you a little bit of information about the process. And we try to make it fairly easy. We have our application in several places. You can go to our website and fill it out online. And we were just struggling with making that online application accessible, and I think we've solved the problem. So if you try to apply for it online and have trouble, please let me know, and we're going to talk to our web developers again. But you can fill it out directly online, or you can download it in a Word or PDF format. You can call us, and we'll email the application to you, or we'll mail a hard copy in regular print or large print, or I'm happy to take an application over the phone if you just want to talk to me, and we'll go through everything. And because the application, the main things we're looking for are, is the room in your budget to make a loan payment? And then depending on the size of the loan, we look at your credit history. So I do need to, the application asks for a lot of your budget information, your income and expenses, so it does take a little time to fill that out. So you fill out the application, and we process it usually within a few days. Depending on the size of the loan, there's a time period of when it goes to committee for approval. So if it's a small loan, something we do sometimes get applications for software or laptops or something that could be in the $500 range, and then that's a pretty quick turnaround, usually within a few days. If it's in the loan range of $500 to $1,500, we have a staff committee that it goes to, and that also is a fairly quick turnaround, just a few days. And then if the loan amount is above $1,500, it goes for a decision to our loan review committee, and they meet twice a month on the first and third Wednesdays of the month. So depending on where the application comes in and is ready for whatever upcoming meeting is next, it'll go. And then if the loan is approved, we send out closing documents for you to sign, and we ask for kind of standard things like verification of income and a copy of your ID. And so you sign the document, send them back, and we set up an automatic monthly payment to come out of your account each month or off of a debit card. And then we make the purchase for you. We pay the vendor directly. So if you're going to, for example, buying a CCTV from Site Connection, we'll get an invoice from them, pay them. You would either pick up or have the equipment delivered, and then we'd start that monthly payment. So a couple things we look at. The main thing, as I said, is the room in the budget for a loan payment. And so we do look at all your income and your expenses. Credit is taken into consideration, but we try to be very flexible. We know a lot of you, not this group in general, but the general population at large, a lot of our applicants have medical debt. And so we try to, we weigh that fairly lightly, and it depends on circumstances. Even if there's been a recent bankruptcy, we kind of look at, you know, the circumstances within the last couple years and how finances are being managed. So, you know, there are always a couple things that maybe stop a loan in its tracks. If someone is in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, for example, you need permission from the court to take on another loan, so that's something that would have to be addressed. If you have state or federal tax liens, those have to be addressed. But for the most part, if it's just kind of normal credit situation with a few medical collections. That's generally not a problem. And if there is a major problem with credit, we'll ask you if you have a cosigner or if there's something that you can use as collateral in addition to the equipment. If you have a vehicle that you own outright, for example, we could put a lien on that vehicle temporarily until the loan is paid off. Again, we would pay the fees to do that. So we try to look for ways to make the loan work if it's a case where the applicant doesn't qualify on their own. I'll just kind of give you an idea of the kinds of loans we do. We do a lot of hearing aid loans, and we do computers and software. We do modified vehicles. A couple of years ago, we received some additional funding, and that allowed us to increase our maximum amounts that we could loan from $10,000 to $25,000. Modified vehicles are quite expensive, so you can get a used one for in that range. So we have been doing more of those lately. And then also the vision equipment and software like JAWS, the CCTVs. And also, you know, it's actually quite a variety of things that you might not necessarily think of as assistive technology, but we try to be flexible, and as long as it's related to that person's disability, we've done loans for TVs, for custom shoes, for a mattress. So it really kind of depends on the individual circumstances in that regard. So that is kind of the program in a nutshell, and I'm happy to take questions about the... Yes. Over.
It's to my far right. Okay. And
we're looking.
Yes. All right. Do we have a microphone? If not, Sarah, why don't you shout out the question and then I'll repeat it over the mic. All right, what do you do if you cannot afford a loan but you need to get new hearing aids? And do you guys work, I assume you guys work on various payments and things like that?
Yeah,
like
so that that is a very tough question. I'll just explain a little bit. Before answering that question directly, the loan terms that we offer go up to 5 years. So if a five-year plan is affordable, we can make that work. We also have another program that is a matched savings program that has some grant funds. It's called Individual Development Accounts, and that requires saving a certain amount every month, a minimum of $10 a month, and over a three-year period. And then once you've saved 50% of the cost of the technology, you're matched with a grant for that same amount. So it's a way to double your money. So that's a nice program. We do have a waiting list for that, but we're trying to raise money for that every year. So it's a good idea to get on the waiting list because we do move people off and into the savings program every year. So sometimes, so planning long term, that might be a good way. Hearing aids, we often refer folks to, there are a few programs that offer aids, either new aids or refurbished aids for a low cost to low income people. So we have a resource sheet that we send to people. The Hearing, Speech, and Deafness Center has a program. The Lions Club Foundation has a program, and the University of Washington has a program. So it's a matter of applying to these programs and showing that you can't afford a regular payment on a $6,000 set of hearing aids, for example, and you may be able to get aids for several hundred dollars instead of several thousand. It is a big problem, though, and unfortunately I don't have the answer to that. Hearing aids are generally pretty expensive and are not covered very well by anybody. So.
Any other questions? No, we don't have time for any more questions.
Oh. Okay. Sure. No problem.
I wasn't trying to kick you out. Okay. Do you guys have? Are you guys?
Yes,
yeah.
We have. A
so they are WAF is they are in exhibits. So I would encourage you that if you do have more questions, to stop by their booth. Help me thank Kathy. And this is definitely a program that, if you guys are needing technology, I really encourage you to take a look at this. And
and see what can be done. So, oh gosh, whatever shall we do now? Sorry, I couldn't hear you. All right, we'll do one door prize. Lene? And be sure to turn that microphone on.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Lene is our door prize. Help me thank Lene Noggle for doing this, you guys. Yeah, you guys better be extra nice to her. And Lene, is it your first? Is it your first convention?
In a way it is, yeah.
In a way it is. So yay! So welcome.
Thank you.
All right, Lene, tell me what you got and who you have.
Well, we have a darling basket here donated by Haley Akers, and it has in it some aloe-infused socks, and it has five handmade cards with that are tactile, and then it has a tube of lotion. It's probably aloe, but it's very nice. And the winner is, yeah, I know, slow.
No, no, you're doing fine. You're doing good.
The winner is.
As long as it says M-E-K-A.
Yeah, there you go.
W-H-I-T-E.
It looks like Young Choi.
Yeah. Young, are you here? Ooh, okay. Keep it going.
Another one?
Oh. Yes. Wait, is Young here? Okay. Don't start giving me false hope for your guys. All right.
Okay, the next one is Howard Ferguson.
Hey, Howard, are you here?
Oh.
No, Howard? All right, let's keep going.
Okay.
It pays to stay here until the break.
Yeah, there you go. Casey Duttmer.
Casey's here.
Okay.
Yay, Casey.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much,
to
Lene.
Stick it in there. Okay. You're welcome. Oops.
So to let you guys know that when you come, we have the awards luncheon coming up. Be there or be an octagon. So... And that's going to be an evergreen F, as in Frank. I want to encourage, empower, challenge you to sit by someone that you don't know. And did I hear no? I have good ears. Don't say no to me. get a chance to meet people that you don't know. And strike up a conversation, you guys. There will also be there might be some door prizes if you're really good. And again, thank you ACB Radio for listening in. We are so honored and pleased to have you. And thank you Deb and Rick for making that happen, because they are just back there doing all that streaming. And we will see you after lunch. Let me give you a time, because you know what happens when you don't get here on time, right? Yeah. Okay. It looks like 1:30. So be back in here at 1:30. I would say 1:25, because I know how y'all are. So, all right. So thank you guys so much for letting me facilitate. And have a good lunch.
Bluetooth microphone. We still have the Bluetooth microphone.
We still have somebody's
Bluetooth headset up here in the front right of the room. If someone
I want it.
Knows who lost one.